Welcome to episode 408 of Radio Free Nintendo. I am your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are James Jones.
I don't have anything to read today.
And Guillaume Veillette.
Are we supposed to read off something? I'm not sure. What?
He's talking about the... We'll get into it in a minute. But John Lindemann is... I should note, John Lindemann, not with us this week. I don't know why. He had some kind of planned absence. So we hope he's having fun or taking care of business, whatever he's got to do this week. But we will look forward to having him back next time. The streak is unfortunately broken. So it's a three-man crew this week, and that may result in a shorter show, but I usually regret saying that when I do. So I'm not going to say it. We'll just jump into it, but I want to let people know we have listener mail coming up later in the show and some really, really interesting questions there. So look forward to that. First up, though, new business, lots of new games that we're playing. And even with three of us here, I think we have more than enough to talk about. So, Guillaume, why don't you go first?
Yeah, sure. So I've been busy with Persona Q, which came out last week, and I haven't really spent as much time with it as I would have liked, because turns out that when you release a game like this in the middle of, Smash Brothers, and
December 2nd.
Yeah, I'm kind of busy with other games and with life and with shopping, what have you, so I've been playing maybe like 5-6 hours. I'm not even out of the first maze yet, but first things first, Persona Q, if you haven't heard, it's this game where they put basically Persona DNA, Persona characters from Persona 3 and 4, actually, and they put that in an Etrian Odyssey game. And
lots of crossovers with Persona DNA on them. That's all I want to say.
Oh, yeah. Well, sure. But in this case, like, it's really, you're playing a... you're playing a an Etrian Odyssey game, through and through, except... for the combat, basically. The combat is still turn-based. It's still first person, and it does look like the combat in Etrian Odyssey, but your characters are not evolving the way that they would in an Etrian Odyssey game. You're not choosing from a skill tree. Instead, your characters are leveling up in the way that they would in the Persona game, which means that they are leveling up by gaining experience and kind of rising in levels that way. But also, there's this whole idea of you capturing demons or personas and just like fusing them together to create new ones, to give them new abilities, and you assign them to each character in your party. And so you will gain their special attacks, and you will also like modify your own stats through that. So, you know, that is the main difference with an Etrian Odyssey game.
It's not totally unlike the Materia system from FF7.
If you say so, I still, I haven't really, I got maybe through like 10 hours of that game.
Well, I mean, yeah, that game just came out. I understand.
Yeah, I know.
Well, Guillaume, what I'm most curious about with, I've actually been playing a little bit of Persona 4 Golden lately on my Vita, which I've tried multiple times to get into. It's still, I played more of it just because I had a lot of time, but it still hasn't captured me. But, I'll keep trying. We'll see. Maybe one day I'll magically fall in love with Persona. But so much of that game takes place in a high school, and you're going through dialogue trees, and you're trying to woo girls, and you're joining the basketball team, and you're building up all these social links and stats. Is any of that in Persona Q?
Well, no. They got rid of some stuff. The whole social links thing, that's gone. You're not really living like life daily in a high school. You're not building up your kind of like you're not studying for exams or any of that.
They got rid of some stuff, the Persona stuff, basically.
Well, as I said, the Persona stuff, like. Persona stuff comes mostly through the combat and the leveling up, and also some, you know, the personality of the characters and the kind of the tone of the dialogue and stuff like that. Because Etrian Odyssey, you know, is not especially like known for its, storytelling or anything like that. Like, you would build your own characters, you would choose their classes and stuff like that. And you would not, they would not be characters. You would be interacting with townspeople when you go to town. But they tell you always the same generic stuff. Like your characters don't have personality. It's a
franchise where they have remakes where they literally add a story to the earlier games in the series.
Right. So I have not. Yeah, and I have not played the remakes, but I have played the demo for Untold, and I wish I had researched this. It's in one of the older episodes. So if you want to look that up, but basically I was not impressed
related
with
content
the demo.
On Tender World Report.
I was not impressed with the way that Untold in the demo at least was kind of stopping the action every couple of steps to have these absolutely boring characters talk to each other and explain the game to you, or explain the game to each other and being like, oh, I'm amnesiac, I don't remember anything. So it's very contrived, and there was a lot of dialogue that was just boring to read. In this case, of course, I'm speaking as someone who has played most of Persona 3 and who really loved Persona 4. I like the characters more, and I find the humor funny, and I like the way that they interact, and I do enjoy these kind of little vignettes, like you're exploring a dungeon, you come up at a dead end, and there might be something, there might not be, but sometimes it will just be, like a dialogue scene, and I actually enjoy reading those, whereas in demo for Untold, it was just like, oh my god, like, can you shut up? This is just a distraction. There are some problems with Persona Q. The major one is that the game does a better job at introducing Etrian Odyssey elements than it is at introducing these characters that it's, throwing at you.
I think that might be deliberate, though. My guess is that they felt like that's the one that needed the boost here.
Maybe, but not on 3DS.
Let me just translate real quick, though. James, are you suggesting that this game was made to introduce Persona fans to the Etrian Odyssey series versus vice versa?
I think the implication is that the crossover effect is going to be stronger with Persona people crossing over to play this game.
Yeah.
Remember, this was one of like 9 Persona 4 spinoffs that got announced the same day.
Yeah.
Including like a Vita Hatsune Miku game, for God's sake.
I agree that that's probably the thinking here. But the problem is that 3DS owners or Nintendo-only owners know Etrian Odyssey. They don't know Persona. So if they want to take this as kind of like their entryway to the Persona universe, it does not a good job of, exposing that, of introducing that, to Nintendo players.
Well, it seemed like all the different platforms for these weird spinoffs that they did with Persona, it seemed like they were kind of trying to pair up with a genre or a series on each of those platforms that was already popular with that fan base. Mm-hmm. So I agree that it makes sense that most people who play this will have at least messed around with Etrian Odyssey, whereas they may not even have a system that plays Persona games.
Exactly. So I think that is a problem, but at the same time, I think that if you're debating between buying this and buying Untold, I think that this game is probably the one with the, more interesting characters and the more interesting story.
Sure.
But you're kind of starting off without knowing these people, and nothing is really done to introduce them to you. Like, I'm sure you'll come to understand, okay, this is like the goof off, and this is like, I don't know, like, this girl really likes meat. I don't know.
This is
like,
why anime stereotypes exist, right?
But yeah.
Are these the same characters from aren't they kind of remixed from the Persona 3 and 4?
Yeah, it's interesting. What they did was that they put both groups in that game, and you can choose at the beginning which group you're going to start off with. So you can just select between Persona 3 and Persona 4, and eventually in the story, I'm not even at that point, but eventually in the story, you're going to meet up with the other gang. But so far, like, it's very much, I chose Persona 4, so this is the Persona 4 gang having kind of side adventure during a specific event in the Persona 4 game. You kind of guess that at some point, spoilers, they're going to forget that all this happened. I don't know. But it's very much, as I said, you're not in the high school. You're kind of thrown in this parallel universe. It's based on Alice in Wonderland.
Sounds a bit like Majora's Mask, too.
Yeah, so far I've been like chasing a rabbit around, and I've found a potion that shrunk me, and I went through a door to find a key. Like it was,
it's, oh wow,
yeah. So it's very much a side story, and at least you can enjoy that if, I don't know, you enjoy Alice in Wonderland stuff. But yeah, so I'm enjoying the game a lot. I think that people who have played either Persona 3 or 4 are going to get the most out of this game. If you already love Etrian Odyssey, you're going to have a blast. And so I'm having a great time with it. And yeah, I don't know what else to say. Like, you might be surprised if you're coming from the Etrian Odyssey side with kind of, you know, like you're getting like a bunch of anime tropes. And you're getting a lot of like J-pop. I mean, it might be a little bit unsettling at first to get like this rap in English, but this rap like during battles, you know, and it's just, it makes no sense. And then like the girls start singing, and I can't really quite make out the music when I'm the lyrics when I'm playing without headphones. But every time, like, one thing that's very clear, at some point she says a really nice guy, and I'm just like, this is battle music? She's singing about getting noticed by like some guy at school or something? You kind of have to take it in stride, or I don't know, like shrug it off. I've seen some people praise the battle music. I personally don't really get it, but anyway, that's what you're getting with Persona Q.
Some people really do like J-pop.
They do. They do.
It's just a matter of taste.
I could get into what they do with the combat system. Maybe I'll get back to it, because this is like a 50-hour game. So we'll come back to it.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are really, really, really liking it. For me, it seems like a bridge too far, but I'm sure that both you and James will be spending a fair bit of time there.
This game is $50. And if the prospect of paying $50 to see if you even like the Persona side of it or not, like if that's a little bit unappealing to you, do check out right now. I think that Etrian Odyssey 4 is on sale for $15 on the eShop. I think that's also, you know, probably the safer bet if you want to be introduced to the Etrian Odyssey playstyle.
Cool. Good advice. And why don't we switch it around here, and we'll go kind of through a cycle and get back to as many games as we have time for.
Sure.
So I'll go next and just mention that I finally finished Bravely Default. I'm guessing a lot of people started that game and did not finish it, maybe more than most.
So wait, pause button. Which ending?
The ending, the final.
Okay.
I did everything. I basically, I didn't 100% it, but pretty close.
You went through the nightmare.
Yes, I went through all 8 chapters and...
Oh, God.
Yes. And so I played most of this like back around the beginning of the year when it first came out. You know, we talked about it for weeks here on the show. And I just got to the point where, you know, there is a part where they make you go back through the game again. It's weird because it feels like, you know, this idea of New Game Plus, which has been around in RPG since at least the Super Nintendo, maybe before then. But it's become like a kind of a standard feature where even action games have a New Game Plus now, you know, like with Shovel Knight. It's very common. And it's really weird to see that basically baked into the story of the game. This idea where they're going to send you back through the game. You're going to all the same places and talking to the same characters, but they're all harder. They say slightly different things. And your characters are aware that are self-aware, like they know that they've been through all this before, and it takes on this weird kind of Groundhog's Day vibe to it. But you know, we're talking, even the second time you go through, when you're more powerful, they do jack up the monsters so much that it can take a long time to grind through that again, even though you kind of know where to go and what to do. Even that took me probably 10 hours. Of 5 or 10 hours of like leveling up and getting strong enough. And that's where I basically quit last time. Cause it was just I was like, I don't want to go through. I didn't even know that you end up going back through the game again and then again on top of that. I mean, it's absurd. And it does seem to go faster every time you go through, because you're getting, at some point you sort of break the game. It gets to the point where really only bosses pose any threat to you. And even them, they don't change that much from cycle to cycle, and so you can use the same tactics, and you gain so much experience and job points from beating those bosses, and you're just kind of doing it one after the other. So after a while, it feels like the game isn't really that challenging anymore. And I got through it the way I finally sort of forced myself through the rest of this mess of a campaign, a story, is that I just turned off random encounters. And probably some people will hate that idea and would say, oh, you desecrated the, you know, whatever. But it's the only way I was ever going to get through it. I was like, I'm not going to sit here for another 50 hours just to try to see the end of this story that I hated before. And so I love that the game gives you that option, and I love that it sort of self-balances, because you do get so much experience and money and job points from these bosses, which you have to kill, that you can just sort of warp from one to the other and just kill boss, boss, boss. And it turns into this weird boss rush thing. And even then, it's pretty repetitive, because you do have to go through the same places and the same events over and over. But sort of making up for that also is the fact that I think the story gets way better in this second half. I think it starts to, once you sort of realize what's going on and why things are the way they are, and you also get way more deep into the lore of the world and why things are set up the way that they are. And it's more interesting and probably a lot darker than you might expect from the first half of the game, where you're seeing everything for the first time. So I like that they went that direction with it, and it definitely kept my interest, and it made me want to not listen to the voice actors still, because I think they're horrible, but I at least wanted to read the text, which is more than I can say for about the first 30 hours of this game. So it ended kind of on a weirdly strong note for me, just because by the end, I did kind of care about the characters and the world and what was happening. I thought it was at least kind of interesting. And the job system, you get to where it's pretty easy to max out jobs, and it's pretty easy to, if you want to specialize, you could do that really easily. But at some point, I had mastered like 5 or 6 jobs per character, and they were all different. So my characters felt powerful and had tons of options to customize them, but they also felt different from each other enough, because I had grown them in different directions over the course of the game, that I kind of felt that they each had their own battle identity as well. And that's meaningful in a game like this, where you do so much battling. So, boy, Bravely Default, I'm still super mixed on, even after spending like 90 hours with it or whatever. I haven't looked at the clock lately, but it was a lot of time.
It's a big game.
It is a big game. It's way too big. I mean, it should have been less than half the length that it is. And, you know, I don't mind long games like Xenoblade, but see, Xenoblade doesn't recycle content the way that Bravely Default does. And it's probably, you know, because they wanted to have a super long, epic RPG on 3DS without, you know, spending $100 million to make it. But I think it's a serious issue.
I appreciate the way that they tried to deal with it at the boss rush, as opposed to saying, hey, fight the same bosses again. They kind of remixed the combination of bosses, so you had to do things a little bit differently. And you know,
you're talking about all the Asterix like guys. So those are all side missions. So I just didn't even do those after a while, because I already had the prize from them. I already had the job class that you unlocked.
The only reason I kept doing them was because the skits that you'd get was the most satisfying part of the post game or the late game, because you run into situations where like, four of the most unhinged female Asterisk holders are having, you know, the woman's only Asterisk club meeting. And if you march in on them, they get really mad that you've interrupted the sanctity. And they just start arguing with each other about what the rules of this club are. And then eventually Anya is probably like, I think we should just fight them. And then you just go and fight them. And it's stupid, but it's kind of funny for its own benefit, simply because some of these characters were actually kind of amusing characters. They found ways to use. New ways to use, but God, that game. I mean, God, I probably spent, I would guess, about a quarter of the time with that game was after the first recycle. Well, even the first recycle is not really bad. The first recycle is kind of a plot thing. You know, it's like the second and third where you start to go, wait, what are we doing?
Yeah. Does this ever end? Am I being trolled?
Like the first one, you're kind of like, okay, yeah, well played there, game.
Yeah.
But like by like six,
I don't know, that's giving it too much credit, I think. But it's an interesting idea, and if they did it properly, they could maybe get away with it. You know.
Yeah, I'm curious.
There's something there.
So the second game comes out in Japan, I want to say early next year. I think a demo comes out even sooner than that.
I think there is a demo for Japan before the end of this year. And yeah. I'll be voraciously reading all the impressions from that, because I am not that they would address, you know, the late game
right, cause they
type
can't
stuff
know.
That we're talking about. But there's so much that I do like about this game, and I want to like it so much more than I actually do like it. But I feel like there's a redeemable formula here, and a sequel is maybe a ticket to like really mastering what Bravely Default is trying to do, and I'm super interested in that.
There's a tremendous amount of stuff they get right, like really, really kind of a shocking amount of stuff they get right for how I feel about that game. Like, I don't know that I've encountered a game that got so much right, and I walk away going like, ugh.
Yeah, they don't quite close the deal, and that's concerning, you know. But when the game is this long, it has to be enjoyable for the duration. And even Xenoblade really stretched a few times because of how difficult and crazy some of those battles get. But in Bravely Default, it just kind of smacks of, you know, stingy resources or lack of creativity or a rushed development cycle or something. There's just something feels off about just how many times they make you repeat this crap and just how little justification there is for it and how little payoff there is in the end. I mean, I think there's some payoff. Otherwise, I'd be really pissed off about how I spent the past few days. But it does not justify what you just went through. And they've got to work on that.
I think what's interesting about the version that we got is that it's for the sequel version out of Japan, where they've fixed a lot of stuff. But
that's frightening.
my guess is their hand was still somewhat tied behind their back on the end game, because they still had to dispose of that narrative. So maybe they learned quite a bit, because they've effectively gotten to make this game twice now. So certainly they've gotten to, I mean, apparently the difference between the first take and the second is a lot of playability stuff. So maybe now they can focus more, since they've gotten to take a second crack at the playability components, maybe they can take a crack at structural stuff. I will say the video you unlock at the end,
it's really cool.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of stunning in a lot of ways.
It's a bit of the Oculus magic, I think.
Because when you start the game, and I'd forgotten about this, is you have to put that stupid card down, and then you get Agnes telling you about, you know, everything's going wrong.
Just to be clear, you don't have to do the AR thing. It's totally optional.
That is fine. That is the start of the game. That is what they prompt you to do. But it's just like, all right, that's great. She's just talking, whatever. This is like a million times cooler than that. Like, it's so many ways. Like, that time she's talking, I'm just trying to find stupid places to put her. It looks like she's popping out of dumb garbage. But like this one, I was like, yes. The fact that it's all around you is probably the best part.
It's an action scene. I mean, there are things worth looking at. It's not just a character standing around and talking.
I mean, there is action at the end of that sequence, but this is a fight. Like, this is a real, and I like that they made it so as you pan around, you see different action. Like, that was really cool. And it did a good job tracking it, which is probably the most amazing part.
I was really surprised at how it held together.
So, I don't know. I have some faith that the second game will be better.
Yeah, Bravely Default is a fascinating game, and I hesitate to recommend it because I think it's extremely problematic, and a lot of people will not have the patience for it, but it got me through, you know, a long vacation where I was on long car rides.
I think if you understand what you're going into, and by that I mean that you are dealing with a very traditional RPG that has a bad thing that it does to cause you to go, God damn, will you just end? like if you know that going in, and the first part of that sentence is still enticing to you, I think there's enough in that first iteration of the game to make it worth it.
Yeah, as traditional RPGs go, I think it is as good, probably better than Ni No Kuni in terms of getting
systems, absolutely.
The mechanics, I don't think it's nearly as charming or as I don't like it as much as Ni No Kuni, but it plays better in a lot of ways.
The thing is, I found a lot of Ni No Kuni's charm just to be superficial. Like, it was all in the presentation. I didn't really like the combat. I didn't like the world exploration. I didn't like hey, now that you're here, go all the fuck way over there.
Right.
Like in this game, like, I felt like all that stuff worked great. I feel like the mechanics of the game work fine. It was the structure of the narrative that where things broke down.
Also, the characters were lame.
I actually like some of the characters in this game. I really do.
But I will say, even though like it's probably not going to be one of my top games of the year, spoilers. I did stop at the first opportunity, the first ending that the game provides if you take some sort of shortcut. And that was still 40 hours of gameplay, and I'm still happy that I invested that time in the game. Maybe because at that point when it came out, it was just, there was not much on 3DS.
It was early
anyway.
Year. There wasn't much going on at that particular moment in time.
Yeah.
I'm curious, Guillaume, did you feel that the ending that you got when you kind of took the early out, was it at all satisfying? Did it feel like, okay, now it's okay to stop playing?
Well, I kind of got the feeling of, okay, that's what that game is going for. I don't need to see more.
Yeah, like the first ending, basically, they just kick the can down the road. The big bad, they're just like, just go away for a few more 100 years. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Right. And you, but at least you learn its identity, I guess. And you,
yeah, you do.
But you might not save the world. And I'm like, well, who cares?
You just sort of, just like, well, I'll be dead by the time it's a problem again. So whatever.
Yep. But it sounds like it's a far cry from letting the moon crash into Terminal.
No. I mean, there's another game, and I'm blanking on it that it was, but it's like your choices actually deal with the big bad, or just like, nah, fuck
that's,
it, my grandkids
Fire Emblem
took care
Awakenings.
Of it. Oh, I didn't even realize there's two endings of Fire Emblem. I just rampaged that game.
Yeah, there's a decision you make in the last mission affects the story, whether you kick the can down the road or end it all.
Not my problem, bitches!
All right, well, anyway, that's enough Bravely Default. I just wanted to sort of brag that I actually finished it because I feel like I deserve something for all that time. But anyway, let's move on to what James has been playing.
Sure. So we talked a lot of Smash last week. Weirdly, none of us are going to talk about it today, but obviously that has been...
I haven't
been...
played it in a week because I've been traveling.
Oh, so. Okay. So, I mean, that's obviously dominated a ton of playtime for me. Lots of getting online with John and then listeners jumping in and being subjected to just idiocy. I will tell you, Kalos Pokemon League, Gus Bella's only 2X Smash 20-minute coin battle is the fucking stupidest thing you will ever experience. And I strongly encourage you to go online and do that. But what I have been playing a bit of recently, just to kind of get some new blood on the show, I expedited playing this. I threw in the first Bayonetta. So I bought the Bayonetta 2-disc version and threw Bayo1 in because I played a little bit of Bayo1 when it came out, but I never really got into it, didn't really own it. So I just went through it and said, all right, I'm gonna experience this game because what everybody tells me is that Bayo2 does everything Bayo1 does correctly. It does better. So it's sort of like, what's a good example? Kind of like Lufia 2, where chronologically the story is, you make, well, put Lufia 2 first, but you can't go back to Lufia 1. Cause it's a good game, but everything is so much better. I ruined it for myself when I went and played Lufia 1 out of order. So I accepted the same philosophy here. I'm going to play this game knowing it's not quite as good as the game on the other side of this multi-disc flap. And I'm going to get through it and I'm going to enjoy it. And about 4 or 5 hours in, and it's really stupid in the best way I can possibly imagine. Like even the opening cinematic, I'm just losing it. Cause it's, I appreciate this game's sense of humor and the game's combat. I'm still trying to get a feel for, it is, although we're going to talk about, use this term, it is a character action game. It's not a type of gameplay I'm super familiar with. I mean, I've played some, I've got some Devil May Cry experience, but I was never really great at those games. Mostly because I don't like to memorize button combos. And it does seem to make a big difference in a lot of those games. If you get to the end of the long combos, you become super effective with them.
Yeah, well, it's weird to hear you sort of lead off with the idea that Bayonetta is just kind of stupid and crazy. And that's the appeal of it. Because I think before Asura's Wrath, and this game did originally come out before that.
It did, yes.
Before that game... and also Saints Row the Third, which was around the same time. I don't know that we really had the right vocabulary in the games media or people who just really talk and think about this stuff and write on forums and stuff. I feel like people weren't really talking about that sort of experience and why it might be cool. And so at the time, I remember, 5 years ago when the first Bayonetta came out, and when I rented it, what I thought it was a really serious, hardcore version of Devil May Cry. And because the mechanics are super solid and because Kamiya is really into that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
To me, the general zeitgeist around Bayonetta, or I should say the consensus around it, was that people who already really love Devil May Cry and God of War and like play them on the hardest difficulty thought it was amazing. Yeah. And that it was weird. And the weird was just sort of this indifferent, I don't understand the story, whatever. Hmm. You know, and so when I played it, I remember thinking, well, I sure don't know what the hell's going on here. And also when I play it, I don't feel like I know what the hell's going on when I play it. So that's why it didn't really – maybe I just had the wrong perspective
It's definitely not a soft introduction to those kinds of games. And that's not super surprising because if you recall, the PS2, I mean, was littered with games that sort of were like the proto to this. I mean, you can go all the way back to like Onimusha and start at like the starting point for these kinds of games evolving. And, well, that series diverged heavily in a different direction.
With Jean Reno.
Well, that's not the diversion I was talking. I mean, it maintained more of its brawler roots because effectively these games have, you know, that's kind of where they branch out from, and it sort of maintained that path. It didn't really evolve out that way. But then you have like the Devil May Cry series where it started to get super into this.
Yeah, somewhere out there, Ty Sugard is like screaming about the Final Fight third person thing.
Final Fight Streetwise, and that's a game where you stomp roaches for money. That's wow. What you do in Final. I've played it. That's what happens. There is a fucking mini game where you stomp roaches. But I mean, this game I think was made. I mean, Kamiya had already, you know, he'd worked on Devil May Cry games. He'd worked on a bunch of stuff like this. You know, this was his ability to say, all right, I'm gonna do whatever I want. I'm gonna take that beyond where we've been. And if you keep in mind, like, Devil May Cry games up until DMC were goofy and silly in a lot of ways and deliberately cheesy. I mean, Dante is possibly the goofiest character in an action game. I mean, short of Rico, eat my bullets. I mean, it's really – but he's deliberate. I mean, this is what he's meant to be. I mean, he is who he is. And this game, like, the opening cinematic for this game alone is – of Bayonetta, I'm referring to, is just – goofy and ridiculous in all the right ways. So I was really happy to see that. But you're right. Goofiness was never something that people really spoke about kind of lovingly.
Like that, people might comment on it, but it wouldn't be the reason to play that game. And it seems like with Bayonetta 2, I mean, and almost retroactively applied to the first game, it feels like that is now sort of what people are talking about. It's the reason people are recommending Bayonetta 2 so much and it's getting Game of the Year hype is because it's so stupid and crazy. And yes, it's a fun action game.
The mechanics of that game are from speaking to people who really are deep into that game, Bayonetta 2 is sort of like, it is the high water mark for mechanics of a game of that type. Like, so the people who are big into the mechanics think that game is amazing.
I wonder because I want to play this. I want to buy it. But I just wonder, is it actually accessible or are people just sort of fumbling their joysticks through it just because they want to see the story and they know they're terrible at it and it's kind of okay? Because I can tell you with Wonderful 101, if you don't master it, you ain't playing it. That game is like a rock wall. I mean, you have to get incredibly good at it to even just progress the story. And the story's not – it's cool, but it's not really worth it, I think.
My biggest issue with Wonderful 101 really came down – from a playability standpoint, really came down to trying to draw those shapes in the heat of battle. Because I felt like sometimes it just wasn't responsive and you'd get the wrong thing and it was just a real pain in the butt. This game obviously doesn't have that. And – I mean, you could turn the difficulty way down. I haven't. I'm hammering through it on what they call normal, which I think is the highest difficulty you can play at when you first start.
Right.
And, you know, I'm jazzing through it okay. I know I'm not good, but I have gotten better. Certainly the dodging mechanics, I've started to really get an understanding of how to use those to my advantage and how to kind of fumble into a combo after I've engaged Witch Time. I'm still trying to get through. You know, I'm still trying to get through the basics of this sort of combat game. So hopefully by the time I'm done with this one and I roll into Bayo 2, I'll be good. But we'll see. I mean, it's like I said, I'm having fun with it. And I played like 3 hours today and looked at it and went, oh, I need to get ready for the show. All right. And then I was like, well, I'll finish this level. And then I was like, uh-oh, I haven't had dinner yet. Which is why I was late for the show, everybody. But
it's all Bayonetta's fault.
I did it for the show.
Personally, like, I don't have a lot of experience with that type of game. I played DMC, you know, last year. That's about it. Or earlier this year. But, yeah, and some Onimusha. But the mechanics are not that hard to grasp. The combo stuff is a little bit harder. Like, you definitely gain an advantage when you know the combos and when you know what they're good for. But that is really only crucial to know in some very cordoned off areas of the game. There are like these challenges that you can find usually when you backtrack to a place when you're quote unquote not supposed to. Like you've gone through a cutscene, let's say, like some new enemy shows up and goes some direction, and if you decide, oh, you know what, I'm gonna go back to where I came from, you're gonna find this portal that brings you to a challenge area. And some of the challenges are like, destroy these enemies in like 3 punches and 4 kicks. Good luck. I have not been able to do them. You don't need to do them if you want to finish the game. But if you understand the combo system, probably, I hope you can actually, you know, win the challenges.
Yeah, as long as they're actually optional, I'm totally fine with that.
They're
approach.
Absolutely optional. And if you want to go through the game, really, like you've got, I don't know if you've got infinite tries when you die, but I've never seen a limit. Like I've never reached a point where like, oh, okay, you're dead like 5 times. Now you start from over again.
I haven't gotten over 2 so far, so
right.
I don't know.
Right. So maybe there's a limit, but I haven't reached it. And you do have items that you can, you know, buy and stuff like that to heal yourself. It's going to penalize you in terms of points. But if you don't care about the points, if you just want to get through the game again, like it's very forgiving.
Very liberal checkpointing too. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah.
Oh, that's good.
I want to be good at these kinds of games because I think they're something that I personally could enjoy. I mean, you know, we talk about the ones I've played, not that many. But yeah, Azura's Wrath is technically a game of this style. It's just not a very good one. It's a very stupid one, which is why I went through it. But I mean, it's regarded as being kind of a very poor example of the genre. So I would like to be good at them in part because, you know, my experience with the first Devil May Cry, knowing 2 is kind of regarded as being just bleh, and 3 is better. Like I'd like to go through those because I can buy the HD collection now for like $15. Like, I want to be good at this kind of game because these kinds of games do come out every so often and they have, you know, a fan base that is very, very ravenous about them. And sometimes when I play them, I'm like, well, I'm having a lot of fun right now. And then other times I'm like, this is terrible. I hate myself and I hate everything in the world. Like, I feel like if I got good at those games, I would have a lot more of the first than I would of the second.
I would fit in Zone of the Enders, especially the second one. Feels a lot like one of these character
maybe
action games.
But you're moving in 3D which complicates matters, and I played Zone of the Enders, even the second runner. I played Zone of the Enders kind of at a range, like I was trying to use range to my advantage often, so it was kind of a different experience for me. I think what's interesting about that game is you can play it a couple different ways, and then at 2, once you get the upgrade and you can warp, I mean the whole game's just broken. The game's just
That's when it gets real good.
That's when it gets really good, but it's broken as shit. I mean, that like at that point, the only thing that matters is the final boss, and everything else is just cannon fodder.
It's amazing. So, Guillaume, why don't you tell us about another game you've been playing?
Paper Monsters Recut is this port of an iPad game. It got a good review on our site, but it's this very basic 2D platformer. It looks great, of course, like with a name like Paper Monsters, you can guess that, yes, it they do try to go for the papercraft look. Your little character kind of looks like, you know, like a cardboard character. He's cubic, like his head is a cube, and his face looks like it's been, drawn there with a pen. So you run around and you jump on enemies, and that's basically the game. Like, They don't use the paper theme at all. Like, this is not, what was that Vita game called?
Tearaway.
Tearaway. So this is not Tearaway. This is not even like the first Paper Mario. It's very much just an art style, and it's just to be cute. And other than that, it's a very, very standard 2D platformer. For most of the game, or at least for the beginning of the game, your only actions is basically running and jumping. And eventually, you do run into stages where you get some sort of gun, and you do control some sort of submarine at some point, but, it stays very basic. And, I can't say that I'm enjoying it much. Also, I think I'm kind of over 2D platformers for the most part that are just single player. I wish I could play this at least cooperatively, because that would just make it more interesting, right? This would be something I could share at the very least. And
maybe Nintendo's just spoiling you.
Maybe. But like in this case, I'm playing by myself, and I kind of feel like, you know, I could be doing something better. And so yeah, like it's a decent game. If that's what you're looking for, and if somehow you cannot get that fix another way from another better game, sure, go for it. But personally, I just feel like, oh, okay, I've made another mistake going for the games that are on sale on the eShop instead of the games that I know are good. You know, like I probably should have paid the $15 for Stealth Inc. 2.
Yeah, you should have.
Yeah, but instead I went and paid like $4 for this game, and it was a mistake.
Stealth Inc. 2 has local, maybe online co-op.
It's $5 closer to getting your last $5 code out of the Nintendo Digital Premium product.
I know. Like, that's the thing. I've not been proud of myself, because I've fallen back into that trap of buying games on sale in provision for some future drought, which will never happen because I already got a backlog, you know? And I'm like, well, it's on sale right now, and
it'll go on sale again.
Tis the season, Guy.
If I buy it right now, also I get the digital deluxe promotion points. So
yeah, but think of it this way: it's on sale. You're getting less digital deluxe promotion points.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, I know. You should pay the regular price.
Think about how close you are to the next one. Are you realistic? By the way, check it if you forgot to check this thing, because they expire in March, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Realistically, how close are you to one?
Yeah, actually, you must, like, they stop calculating, they stop, you stop acquiring points on December 31st,
yep.
And you can spend them until next year, December 31st.
I think you could still claim the certificate, James. I think you just can't earn points after the end of of this year.
This year, at the end of this year, you stop acquiring points, and at the end of next year, you lose them. If you haven't redeemed the codes, you lose them.
There's a whole year to remind people, hey, go see if you have any.
I think right now they remind them, hey, if you're really close.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, sure. I mean, if you could spend $5 on the eShop, you know, in the last couple weeks of the year and get $5 certificate, which you might otherwise never get, it might be worth doing that, you know?
Right.
So if there's $10 worth of stuff you want. So anyway, yeah, I wonder, I don't recall if you ever brought this up, but did you spend any time with Cloudberry Kingdom? Because it seems like it's even a little bit paper crafty, but that's a fun, crazy game, and it supports up to four people, actually.
Yeah, I don't know, I like my games more, like my platformers, less physics-based, perhaps, or not as crazy.
It is a little physics.
I'm very wary of the whole, what's it called? Not randomly, but
the procedurally generated.
I
think you should be wary of it until you try it, and they really should do a demo, like a time-limited demo of that game, but
right.
I think once you try it for yourself, you'll be really surprised at just how playable and interesting the levels tend to be.
Yeah. Well, it might be something to check out after Stealth Inc. 2, most probably.
Yeah. Mm. Alrighty. Well, I'm up next, and I'll talk a little bit about Geometry Wars 3. I don't know if you guys remember me talking about Galaxies. It was quite a long time ago.
I do remember, but it was a long-ass time ago.
I played the ever-loving shit out of Geometry Wars Galaxies on the Wii. Like, I think more than most people. And I hold that game in extremely high regard. I think Geometry Wars 2 is probably a better game when you consider that it was a fifth of the price. And it didn't have as much content, but it was much more sort of dense and like manicured, and it felt really well thought out. So I adored, I mean, I've also probably played 100 hours of Geometry Wars 2. So, I mean, I love this series. But I think Galaxies on Wii is highly underrated. Plug in your classic controller and go to town on that guy. It is, if you want more Geometry Wars, I'm sure you could pick up a copy of that game for less than Geometry Wars 3 costs, and you could play it on your Wii U, which unfortunately you can't with 3. Right. But I'm playing on PS4, and I really like it. It's almost like Smash Brothers in that these games, the appeal of them sort of lies in their longevity, and I haven't had it for long enough to, I've only been playing it for like a day and a half. So I haven't had it long enough that I know for sure whether it's going to stick with me and whether I'm going to get totally absorbed in it like I have the other ones, but it feels right. And I think it could very well happen. And it has, you know, really good online leaderboard integration, cause it's on PS4, and it has a good friend system, on that system, which is something Galaxies severely lacked.
Yeah.
It's on the Wii. There's not a whole lot to be done about that. And that game ultimately was about playing through these sort of campaign, and that worked on me, and that grabbed me and addicted me way more than I would have expected. And the cool thing about Geometry Wars 3 is that it has its own campaign. I don't think it's quite as extensive as in Galaxies. I mean, this is still only a $15 game, so you probably wouldn't expect quite that much content packed into it, but it's a lot. The adventure mode is really tough, and there's a lot to it. So I'm pretty impressed by the sort of single player, you know, progression-based aspect of it, but it also contains every mode, or almost every mode from Geometry Wars 2, as like a separate thing that you can just go to in the menu and play that. And they all have individual leaderboards. So it's not lacking for content at all. And I really, really like it so far. It looks great too. The big gimmick of it is that they now have all these sort of solid 3D shapes that you're going around and doing your twin stick shooting on. And it's basically something that, you know, Nano Assault has already done it on both 3DS and Wii U. So if you've played those games, and I like those games, they're not nearly as polished. They're not as tight as Geometry Wars. And the art style of those games sometimes makes it a little more difficult to tell what's an enemy and what's not. So that's something Geometry Wars, it's just, it has that simple, clean aesthetic that prevents those kinds of mistakes. But, you know, if you're a really big fan of Nano Assault, this is basically the game that inspired that, and now it mixes in the most interesting thing about Nano Assault back into the original recipe. So it's kind of a no-brainer, but I really like it quite a bit. And playing it really has reminded me, it's kind of got me swimming in nostalgia for Geometry Wars Galaxies and all the sleepless nights that I spent with that game. So if you overlooked it, or if you only played the DS version, which has this kind of, I'm not a fan of the stylus controls, that's really the only way to play that game. If that's the only one you played, then I think you're really missing out, because when you play it with two actual joysticks, the way it was designed on the Wii, that is a fantastic Geometry Wars game. And there's really not much else like it on that system. So at the time, it just totally took over my life. And it's a game I hadn't really thought about lately. So it was nice to kind of go back to that and think, you know, I bet a lot of people never played it. It's like, if they ever do like Wii Virtual Console for Wii U, where you can just download Wii games and play those natively on the Wii U, that would be a fantastic
one. We talk about that a lot with the DS and Wii U, and or DS and Wii, and
Nintendo never brings it up, and I don't understand why.
So I can tell you why they don't bring it up. I mean, and this is based on, you know, what I've talked to people, is that you could conceivably do it, but it would probably not be the experience they want you to have. Because effectively what you'd have to do is you'd have to basically get you'd basically have to create a Wii U disc bootloader, essentially.
It's like a homebrew channel.
Right. That's what you'd be doing.
Yeah.
And
so do it.
That's not the experience they want to create.
Do it, make money. The experience I want to create is actually being able to play these games. So right. make well, that can. Happen. I will pay you for the privilege, and we'll all be happy. I don't care if it doesn't have a suspend feature.
Yeah, but that's them. I mean, it's like GBA games on 3DS. It's like, okay, what are you doing? Why do we still not have these?
If those just went to sleep, like the Ambassador games, if they just went to sleep when you close the lid, that would be perfectly fine. You don't have to build in a crazy home menu for it. Just make it work like a DS game, and I'm fine.
You know what didn't have save states and like suspend features? GBA games.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, I played these games a decade ago, and I was totally cool with them. So instead, though, we get them on Wii U, which is where you want to play your GBA games. Blown the fuck up on a giant screen, or blown mostly up on the screen on your controls.
Yeah, I wasn't going to talk about it, but I have downloaded Super Mario Advance.
I bet it looks assy.
It does look assy. And, you know, the sound is on the GBA wasn't great. And so to have that like amplified on your speakers at home, it's terrible.
I'm 100% hype about seeing what the fucking Fire Emblem looks like on the Wii U. It's gonna look. I mean, that game looked bad on the GBA.
Yeah, at least Fire Emblem didn't have a lot of voice sample.
No, but it's got lots of tiny, tiny, tiny fucking character models that are gonna look awful on their TV on an HD TV. It's gonna be a disaster. I am so excited.
I didn't really hear bad things about Advance Wars, and that's already been done on the Wii U. So it has the same graphics engine and everything. I mean, it's...
A little bit different, though, because they Advance Wars sticks to a lot of primary colors, whereas...
Certainly the art style is different.
Yeah, and the features are exaggerated, and I think that the soldiers have eyes, you know, like big anime eyes, I'm not sure. But yeah, like the Fire Emblem characters, the combat models or whatever, like I don't think they have faces.
Not really.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you, Nintendo. Thank you for that. This is... You know, when I woke up and they announced the Wii U, I'm like, you know what? I can't wait to play GBA games on that shit. That's exactly what I'm waiting for. Thank you, Nintendo. Thank you. Oh wait, no, that's what nobody ever said ever. God damn it.
I wonder if things like GBA and DS support will sort of be part of the new 3DS announcement for everywhere else.
They haven't announced it yet, so I mean, the thing's out in Japan.
It seems like by the time they are ready, for whatever reason, you know, that they delayed that launch outside of Japan and Australia, if by the time they are ready to do it, if they have kind of a few other games to announce with it or a few more lucrative features like that sort of thing, that would make a lot of sense, because if all they've got is a Xenoblade, they're going to have a hard time selling that thing in most places. In Japan, people are just 3DS crazy and they don't give a shit, but... Most people are going to say, yeah, but what does this do that I couldn't do before? And the answer is not much of anything right now. It's nice, but it's not really exciting.
They don't have any experience releasing a 3DS with no games on it.
Their experience is one I would rather not repeat. Let's put it that way. I feel like they kind of need to load up the magazine on this one before they... You know, before they really
they need to buy a mag. They need to go down to the sporting goods store and buy a magazine. They don't even have that right now.
At least tell me that things are coming before you ask me to go out and buy it and take it home.
They've got gunpowder, but it's on the floor. Like they don't even know how it got out of the container. It's just a fucking mess.
All right, well, James, let's go back to you to finish up New Business with one more game.
So when I wasn't getting enough of playing Smash Brothers online with Skype in tow, because the voice chat on Smash Brothers is abysmal.
It's kind of like it's barely there. Like, I'm glad they did it, but man, it's kind of Wii Speak levels of like. Ugh.
It's in the tier of that Pokemon game that had local video chat.
I think it needs to have a tutorial teaching people like where to put the microphone and how to set it up in such a way that it won't completely blow out the mic when you talk.
Yep.
Or blow out somebody else's speakers. Or they need to rebalance with the music, or they gotta do something to make that better.
I mean, there is an adjustment slider in one of the menus to like your mic sensitivity, but nobody's ever going in there.
Yeah, they need to, it's gotta be like Skype. It's like, let me walk you through this. Let's find what's optimal for your living room.
Right. I mean, like I said, this to me feels like the freaking local video chat in that Pokemon game. I mean, you're just in uselessness. I mean, it is effectively a useless feature.
It's rough.
I've never understood what someone was saying over the voice chat on Smash. I mean, I've had people, listeners go, and I'm like, yeah, I agree.
There have been people I've played with where I have to say, I'm sorry, I know you're talking, but I can't understand anything you're saying to me. So let's just play the game.
I have a taunt that just says, I can't hear you. And as much fun as it is playing with John and just coming up with dumb garbage to do to people, I decided to give Fantasy Life Online a try with another staff member. Carly has reached the end game, so she wanted to try the online stuff because, as I mentioned, there are bosses you just can't kill on your own. Like, you just can't do it. It takes forever. So, I mean, it's conceivably possible if you want to devote 3 hours to just chiseling away at their health. So we got the online mode working, expecting it to be just garbage because you're dealing with an ocean. And we use Skype because that game has no voice chat. You have a text entry screen that, as Guillaume mentions, is really slow. Mm-hmm. And it makes it effectively impossible to coordinate combat. And then we went and hunted bosses for like a bunch of hours spread out over the course of a couple sessions. And
you went monster hunting.
Effectively, yeah. And what I found is that that game is infinitely more enjoyable if you're playing with someone who's on the right side of deranged, but not far enough away that you feel like this is a totally safe experience I'm currently having right now fighting this boss with this person. Like, just at the point of like, hey, we have to take shifts to keep him from healing himself while we go heal. Oh, you lured him over here. Thank you. Like, it's that right degree of just the game's combat is such that you can kind of, especially if you're a ranged character, just kind of, you know, pepper them for a really long time and dodge and evade. And with doing that with another person who just happens to be the exact same class as you means there's a lot of just chaos on screen that you can sort of play with and have a good time just sort of experiencing. So I'll say in that context, in the context of multiplayer monster hunting, which has nothing to do with the main game whatsoever, because to beat the game, you don't even have to have a single fight. Like the last 4 hours of the game, there's no fights. I think your previous fight's like you fight a wolf. Just random ass wolf. Just run around, just harass people. Just kill them. But so you go out there and you hunt these dragons that are incredibly powerful and just completely wreck house. And then like you get a prize that doesn't feel like it was worth the effort and you get a ton of experience. And then you go past the dragon thinking, now I'm going to go to this unexplored area and there's another dragon. And you're like, oh, more dragons. You fight another one. Overall, you spend like 30 minutes fighting a boss and you think, wow, this was a really strange use of time. But there is something satisfying about having to coordinate. I think the fact that we're both magic users kind of plays into that because we have to spend a lot of time hopping in and out to kind of recover. So there's like managing trade-offs and kind of trying to flow, you know, control the flow of the enemy around so that you're not causing them to turn and attack your opponent, your ally. Like,
yeah, this is the stuff MMO fans love. You know, this is what they live for. This is a raid in WoW or Destiny.
But it's two people. It's two people doing a raid. Like, the stuff that they give you, like the fact you can warp straight to the same screen that person is on. So if you go like, hey, I'll be right back, and the person you're with fucks off and goes somewhere else, you don't have to go, great, where'd you get to? I have to go find you. You just hit a button and you jump to the same screen they're on. And
that's beautiful.
You don't jump next to them, which would be nice. You may be a long ways away, but you're on the same screen at least. Yeah. So it allowed us, and because the game has lots of warping built into it anyway, it allowed us to sort of go on these boss runs where we would take out one boss, it might take 15 minutes. We do another boss, it might take 20 minutes. We do one, it might take half hour, one might take 5 minutes. And we could knock out these bosses that were essentially preventing us from finishing up the mage class and getting all the top level on that. And it was nice to be able to get through them. It was kind of an enjoyable experience playing it with somebody else and getting to laugh when dumb shit happened. Because occasionally, like, the game would lag out and I wouldn't be doing any damage to the enemy and they wouldn't be doing any damage to me. And the other person just saw two sprites disjointed by about 30 feet swinging at the air. And he's like, yep, that's happening. And, you know, the ability to actually take these things down that feel appropriately dramatic because you have to play near perfectly for a long time. Or use a bunch of items. Whereas the boss can, you know, you have to really just, he can just do whatever he wants and you're going to get your shit wrecked pretty badly. Like there's something about that that's appealing, if only because when somebody screws up, the other person can rescue them and then mock them for it.
It's like it's kind of high stakes. Sounds
yeah,
like.
It's high stakes except for the fact that one apparently. You know, she was once she beat the game, she was able to complete the alchemist job tree in like no time whatsoever, and then infinite potions for everybody. So the game, it's like the game just removed all sense of drama. Like I came in, she's like, "Here's 500 SP potions." I'm like, "I don't what? I just made them." I'm like, "Don't you need these? No, I can make them."
It's not just that she can make them on demand; it's that she can just give you as many as she wants.
She can make them at a volume that would make a Chinese factory seem, you know, tiny.
Oh, that's funny. Now, is this only two player?
It's I want to say it's you could do up to four.
Because four, what three, you're talking
three,
about,
three. It's three
okay,
player.
Three. Well, you know that's kind of borderline, but you know, like with all the different jobs that are possible, and you know, if you are using something like Skype to actually do real coordination, it right. sounds like it could be pretty cool. Two players, I feel like you know, you and Carly have a good rapport, and so that's a lot of probably what's going into.
Oh,
your
I mean, a lot of it, a lot
this,
of it's just laughing at us being idiots. I mean,
right. It ends up being kind of something to do while you're having a chat. You know,
it's like, hey, I'm going to go fight this dragon. No, I need to rest for a minute. Oh, I already pissed it off. Oh, okay.
Yeah. With three people, especially if the battles really do get challenging, I could see that being very appealing for some people to get into.
It does
it's kind of like what we were hoping with, what was it, Heroes of Ruin?
Yep. The other thing lets you do, though, is lets you explore deeper into some of these areas that you normally – I mean, you could probably get in there on your own and get deep into this area, but – you're going to get bored before you get to the end of it. So there's this area called the Ancient Ruins, and there's this wall. It's like behind it's called like the Gold Vault. And you're like, oh, well, I need to get in there, but there's a dragon that's going to take you like 5.5 hours to kill. I don't have time for this. Ain't nobody got time for this. But you get in there so quickly. Like it takes
becomes
you.
Becomes Desert Bus at some point.
Yeah, it's like a slog to get to him, and then you have to fight him to get in there. Well, getting there now with two people is just, we're there. And then fighting him, that's still a slog, but at least it's faster and you've removed that initial just, oh God, I don't want to do this. So it sort of opens up the game in ways that if your AI, because you can get these AI partners, but I find like a lot of times they're really stupid. So like I've only got two challenges left to get the highest mage class you can get without buying the DLC, and one of them is to kill this thing. The mages have this thing called wraiths, and you get them throughout the game. You have to kill them. And the last one, the lightning wraith, the person who gives it to you and asks to come with you just keeps using magic he's not vulnerable to against him. And I'm like, well, you're fucking useless, aren't you? Just go stand in the corner. I don't have time for this. I just let him die. I'm like, I don't have time for this. I'm not going to rescue your ass. You're useless. All you are doing is meat shielding me, and you're not good at that. Just get out. I don't have time for this. I'll bring two Shiba Inus with me instead. I mean, so having somebody who's not completely useless actually makes having a party system work, which is – it's sad that that's what I had to come to, but that is kind of a benefit, and eventually you might get through these classes. One other thing I did note, though. I can't remember. Europe got this game a little bit ahead of us, didn't they?
A couple months maybe.
I want to say Nintendo localized it in both regions, but they just went and fucking changed a bunch of things in the North American version, like just proper nouns. It's really confusing.
Well, apparently the localization is better, the North American one. Like, maybe. That's what I've been told. It's just funnier.
But, like, proper nouns? Why? Like, the mage class isn't even the same name. She's like, I'm a wizard. I'm like, what the fuck's a wizard? And I get there, wait, what? Why did they use synonyms? What are they, like, so there's...
So your versions are compatible with each other online, even though they have different translations and...
So, like, so all the quests have different names? So, like, when she's completing quests, I'm like, oh, hey, it tells you when somebody in your party levels up or when they complete a quest. And since we were baiting up her magic quests, we were just knocking them out. Like, I would see it, and I'm like, oh, hey, you got this one. She's like, no, I didn't. And it took us a while to realize, oh, everything's named different. What the fuck, Nintendo? There's actually a place in the game that has a completely different name in the North American version. And it's like both of them are basically saying this is a city that floats above the clouds in its name, but it's completely different. So she's like, meet me here. I'm like, I don't know where the fuck that is.
You know, Mario Sunshine is still weird to me to this day when I see it in English. Because they change all the names of all the levels were in English in the Japanese version. I mean, if you remember, the Japanese version had tons of really hilarious English. That's where
right.
you get Shine Get.
Yeah.
Right.
And so there was tons of English in that game, but most of it bad. And even like the names of places, which I thought were fine, they change those in the English version. And so people will refer to a level in Sunshine and I'll have no idea which one they're talking about because I played in Japanese and I know English names of those places, but they're not the ones that you know.
This was an English to English localization. Like, right. Like, what the hell were they doing? It's like, hey, Europe, if you're playing North American version, there's a place called Terra Nimbus. See if you can figure out where the fuck that is. You won't, because we spent like 5 minutes trying to figure out what we were talking about. It's such a weird game.
That's great. Well, I'm glad you found a way to enjoy it. Finally,
yes.
James.
Yeah.
That's good news for everybody. All right, well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we've got your listener mail, so stick around.
It's Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com. First off this week, we have a review, Sonic Boom, the Shattered Crystal on 3DS. Don is a wounded man. They'll take my word for it. He starts off this review speaking of his experiences with the Wii U Sonic Boom title thusly. Quote, Sonic Boom, the Rise of Lyric hit me hard, and I was reluctant to even start thinking about the Nintendo 3DS game. Thankfully, Don will not need to schedule an extra appointment with his therapist this week, but that's not to say Sonic Boom on 3DS is a good game either.
I know Scott didn't like it very much in his review at IGN. But next up, we have a video called Nintendo's Gamepads, Episode 3, John Raritan's third installment in the video series chronicling the evolution of Nintendo hardware, focuses on the works of Gunpei Yokoi, creator of the Game & Watch, Game Boy, and Virtual Boy. Does history need spoiler warnings? You should go watch it.
Next up, we have a review, World of Keflings. J.P. Corbin thinks World of Keflings does a great job showing you how to do a strategy game with the gamepad, and presents a charming world, but does little else to set it apart. I see things vastly differently. I see a story of systematic cultural memes of a civilized outsider being tasked by the locals to put their affairs in order and to be their hero. Why not make the Keflings the hero, Ninja B? You think only Miis can be heroes? I'm disgusted. J.P. isn't, though, so you should go see how he actually feels.
These are getting long.
Yeah, they are.
All right, next we have a book review called Before Mario. Appropriately, Justin Berube has taken on the task of reviewing a book written by prolific Nintendo toy collector Eric Vasculi. The book documents the products Nintendo made as a toy company up until their entire company's fate changed with the launch of the Famicom. I don't have a joke here, sorry. Oh wait, see if Justin thinks you should collect this book. That feels better.
It does. We also have a review this week of Captain Toad Treasure Tracker. Curtis is a combo text slash video review for Nintendo's Star Collecting Extreme Gravity Puzzle Platformer. Is it time for adventure? Or should you just wait till this is invariably put on sale in the eShop for $20? I mean, it's your money, you can do what you want. But Curtis might have some suggestions.
And finally, we have an editorial called Thoughts on the Lack of Character Customization in Pokemon Omega Ruby and Alpha Sapphire. Whew. Pokemon X
It's a long title.
Pokemon X and Y introduced the ability to customize your personality-less avatar, a feature omitted from the remake of Ruby and Sapphire. Becky Holliday didn't previously expect this to be a major concern, but feelings change. Clothing and hairstyles make the trainer. Pokemon, more than just cockfighting with living WMDs.
Well, just think about it. Think about what the shit this Pokemon can do.
Yeah, I guess some of them are getting pretty crazy. All right.
At the end,
maybe
one of
no
them
child
is
should hold such power.
One of them is the creator of the universe.
Yeah.
That one. An 8-year-old probably shouldn't have that sitting on their hip.
It's amazing that it's willing to live inside those little balls. But anyway, you can go read all of these articles and much more over at our website, NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It is time for listener mail, and as always, the address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We didn't get any emails about the Driver 2 manual from Russia, which makes me sad, But I appreciated the dramatic reading that James gave it.
That was, despite what some people have intimated, that really was my first time reading it. It was not rehearsed. It was not rehearsed. I did not rehearse that. That's
and
all that
I can vouch for the authenticity of the contents that you recited
I never figured out what the Zooland was from.
I have no idea.
I kind of want to know.
Now, here's the best part, James. I bought, by the way, the GBA version of Driver 2, shockingly competent. It runs at like 15 frames per second,
but yeah,
it totally does what it says on the box. It is a GTA 3 clone on GBA, and it is sometimes fun. But I totally bought that game in a store. It was the most respectable looking electronics or entertainment store that I ever saw in Russia, and it's pirated as hell. As the manual makes quite clear.
As I said there, you're buying a game in Russia. Mm-hmm. You know what's up. What's the point of putting in the manual?
Yeah, exactly.
Who are you trying to fool? Because you already have my money.
Yeah.
I've already bought the game.
Are people inspecting this somewhere? And they're saying, well, if this doesn't have a manual, it's obviously a fake. It's obviously a fake.
Like, fake GBA games are the easiest fucking thing in the world to spot. They're super easy.
Yeah. So anyway, I had forgotten all about that manual, and I was cleaning the bookshelves, and I found it, and I immediately thought, I bet James would love this.
Love is a strong word for what happened there. Mostly just confusion and outrage. Just like...
There's a reason I kept it for 11 years.
A real kicker at the end is when they start describing a Konami game and the... in the discussion about, I'm like, you couldn't even steal from the same fucking game. You assholes. There's three games in here. None of them are Driver.
Yep. Okay. Well, anyway, Guillaume is going to read the first email this week.
Leo writes, I decided not to buy the Smash Brothers bundle that had the game, adapter, and GameCube controller because I prefer buying all my Wii U games digitally. That posed a problem I didn't expect. The adapter is completely sold out, and they are selling on eBay for $60 to $80. Do you think Nintendo will hurry and make more of these before Christmas? Or do you think I'll be paying through the nose for it?
So, you're talking about supply line stuff. There's only so fast you can make stuff and get it on the boat from China.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm sure they've got more coming, because they would have had more coming anyway.
Right.
I mean, this
is a hot seller.
Sold through, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean...
It seems like they sold through.
Yeah. So, like I said, you can only expedite stuff so much before the cost of doing it supersedes the marginal gains you get from selling the additional units.
Yeah, but a device like that is small and simple enough, I would guess it won't take more than a couple of months for them to supply more.
Right.
And I'm sure they had some estimates of the interest in that thing anyway.
Oh, sure. I'm sure they did market research on it.
Now, so I do think, you know, by maybe January, February-ish, you know, give or take a month, you'll probably start to see reports about these things coming back in. The problem is by then we'll have been through Christmas. Way more people will have this game, and way more people will want to go find this thing that they've heard about. So the demand might have actually increased by then, even though, you know, some people got it on the first wave. So I don't know that it'll be any easier to get one even once they do flush the market with more units. Mm-hmm. But I would also say, and I really sympathize here with Leo, because I kind of went through this too, and I just decided I'm just not going to get one. I'm fine with Pro Controllers and Classic and, you know, whatever. I'm fine. But I thought about it, and it does suck for people with a digital. Is it even possible to buy the adapter by itself?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, they sold it separately.
They are selling it separately, okay.
Well, they were selling it separately.
Mm-hmm. Well, until they ran out. Okay, but that's good. you know, obviously there was the bundle, and I didn't want to buy the bundle. Although I think if the only way you could get an adapter is to buy a bundle, if you can buy the bundle at a reasonable price, like, you know, more or less retail, like what it's supposed to cost, you can probably get almost full credit for the disc. If you don't need the disc because you've already got it digitally, you can probably either trade in that disc or just sell it on eBay or Craigslist or something and get pretty much the full value of it, would be my guess.
I would guess all those are gone because people are bought whatever was left to sell the adapter on eBay.
Yeah. Yeah, this is actually, like, we answered Leo pretty much immediately when we got the email, but since then, like, this is an old email. Since then, like, they're now $99, you know, starting at $99 from eBay sellers, not eBay, but Amazon sellers.
Yeah, so that's atrocious. Don't pay that. Just wait. You can live without this thing for
a while longer.
Learn to play on a different controller. You may not like it as much, but it won't hurt you to play it on a different controller for a couple of months until this thing comes back, and then you can fix it and be happy with
GameCube. I mean, we've talked about it before. I mean, I think that the Pro controller for the Wii U, which I got one of these with Smash, is totally just capable as for playing this game. It's fine.
Yeah,
it's,
I think it feels great. I like mine. I mean, I like that controller a lot.
The GameCube controller lots of games, is,
but especially Smash, it does really well.
The GameCube controller is 12 years old. It's 12 years old. I mean,
and it's wired, which, you know, if you're in a tournament, that might be a good thing. But I think for most of us who live in the real world and play with real people and in our living rooms, I feel like wired is kind of more of, it's an inconvenience.
Unless you have a waiver, but that thing just chews through your batteries.
And a lot of people don't have those, and those are not on sale now.
No, so. And if you find one, it's expensive, usually.
Yeah.
Like, it's a perfectly capable controller. I think if you spend some time with it, like, I don't even notice I'm using it anymore. And I've probably dumped about 20-ish hours into Smash at this point. Like, it's just the controller I use. It's fine. I mean, I've even played with the gamepad. It's fine. The gamepad's a little bit harder experience, but I mean, I've done
it. It's just heavy, you know. Yeah. The gamepad's just big and heavy, so it's not as comfortable. But it totally works. You've got all the buttons you could possibly need. It's serviceable, at more than serviceable. I think it feels better than the 3DS version. 3DS version was just too cramped and not enough buttons, really. So any of these are better than 3DS.
I still wish the right stick and face buttons position was switched on the Pro controller, but it's not the end of the world.
I actually play with the gamepad, and the girlfriend uses the Wii U Pro. And yeah, the gamepad is fine. And I've actually gotten my ass kicked by some people using the 3DS as controllers, or actually using the 2DS as a controller.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah.
So just to ask real quick, because I haven't tried, do you have to have Smash for 3DS to use the 3DS as the controller?
I think so, yeah.
I don't understand why they would do that.
I guess because there has to be a piece of software that knows that it's being a controller. That's the only thing I can think of. So they could have released like a piece of software you could download for free, but they probably don't really care that much.
Right.
Yeah.
It's weird. That whole thing is weird. Like, hey, you could use 3DS as your controller. Fuck. What the fuck? Why?
It's because it has a player mode and you need controllers. And I think it's a good thing. The more options they do, the more controllers they allow you to use, the easier it is to put together a
giant. Yeah, but you also need
like
a bunch of freaking copies of Smash Brothers 3DS.
Right, but the context that I played it in, like, it was a party. I brought my own Wii U controller. I don't think everyone there had a Wii U, and the host didn't have, you know, a ton of controllers. So it was really handy, like, and it was just, you know, like someone who only has a 2DS or a 3DS, who bought the game for 3DS and goes to an event like that and can play directly on the Wii U. That's pretty cool.
It's still fucking weird. It's still fucking weird. I mean, it is worth noting how fucking weird that whole thing is.
It is weird, but look, the 3DS version sold fantastically well, so there's a decent chance that any random person who shows up at your house with a 3DS will have that game on their system.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to kick their ass out. What the fuck are you? I don't have people showing up at my house with 3DSs. Get out of here.
It's another good reason to have it digitally, though, because, you know, that way it's always on your 3DS, wherever you take it. You don't have to worry about
it. Yeah, I mean, I've decided my digital games based on using it as a controller to play other games on other systems.
No, it's just a bonus. It's just a bonus. Doesn't matter if you haven't played Smash 3DS in a year. It's still on there. You can still use it as a controller in a pinch. I think that's a good thing. But it should not be a requirement. Anyway, yeah, don't pay through the nose for one of these adapters. Just wait. They will come back. You know, I don't know if at some point Nintendo will probably trickle down the supply on them, and they'll only be available in their online store. But they have accessories in their online store for, I mean, some obscure stuff that's, you know.
I bought a Virtual Boy piece on the online store when I was on this show. When I got
the
Virtual Boy.
I think you can probably still buy Wii component video cables.
Probably.
Which were never sold in stores. The first
And they're now selling like refurbished Wii games on there. You can find the first Pikmin Wii Play Control or whatever it was called on their web store for like less than $20.
There's a lot of weird, cool stuff on the Nintendo official web store. So things like this, that's where they go to live once the rush in retail is over. So, you know, eventually they'll be easy to get, I hope. I hope. We'll see. Unless Nintendo treats it like a limited edition thing. But usually with hardware, they don't do that with something like this.
Only scarves.
All right. Well, let's move on to the next email. It's from Tripon, and he writes... So we're nearing a Game of the Year consideration since it's end of the year, which led me to think about how certain genres tend to rise or fall with each generation. This past generation was unquestionably a genre dominated by generation dominated by FPS games and open world games, especially by games that were on multiple consoles. While the third person action game genre that this is not even the same name, but it's basically character action games like we were talking about before, like Bayonetta and DMC, used to champion, they seem to be dying out. My question is, what genre do you think made the biggest leap in terms of progress and innovation this past generation, and which genre did you think declined or took a nosedive? Bonus question, which genre do you think will make the biggest leap in terms of popularity this generation?
I would say with the third person action games, you do include things that are more in the vein of, I mean, anything from Final Fight Streetwise, God help you, to Onimusha, which aren't really character action games. They're more, you know, they hew closer to the brawling roots. And I would say there were a lot of those games on the PlayStation 2, Xbox, GameCube era. I mean, you had everything from like the Two Towers that EA put out on everything.
Yeah, and God of War, of course.
To, you know, stuff like really hardcore Devil May Cry and...
Rygar.
Yeah, like... Oh God, Rygar.
Oh, yeah, that was a thing.
Everything in between. Like, that whole genre. I mean, there were a lot of games that fell in that 3D action space then, and...
It also became eventually, I think, watered down by licensed games, you know?
Absolutely.
It started being like, the Incredibles game is, guess what? It's kind of like a dumb version of Devil May Cry, you know?
Right. Because you can make that, you can make one that's marginally competent fairly easily.
Yeah, like, you know, a genre has really become dominant when it starts to feel like you can just have a generic engine for it or a generic template for it and just slot in whatever movie's coming out this summer.
Right, Wolverine.
Yeah, Wolverine, yeah, a great example.
Oh God, there were so many 3D action Wolverine games, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that genre does seem to be tapering off, though. I think it's maybe more reached sustainable levels. And it's also, over time, become... I think it's become a little bit more entwined with other genres, which is also kind of a sign that, you know, something has become very popular and maybe saturated, oversaturated. And then people look for ways to freshen it up. You know, I think when you look at stuff like Darksiders, it incorporates lots and lots of elements from those character action games. But it's also kind of an adventure, and it has lots of puzzles and lots of upgrades and exploration. And then you look at stuff like Shadow of Mordor, which is also kind of a weird, and Batman, you know, which are more exploration heavy versions of that basic idea.
I would say the other thing that's worth sort of keeping the eye on is that in that genre, especially, there was a lot of kind of closed space kind of stuff. And that was partially a function of the systems they were on. You could do decent 3D models with decent-ish textures, but you couldn't do big open areas of it. So you had these games that were essentially character kill hallways, where you walked into a room and you beat the shit out of some unknown number of characters, and then a door opened and you went to the next room.
Well, keep in mind, I mean, like as you mentioned before, this genre, kind of the character action thing, sort of started with stuff like Onimusha, which used pre-rendered backgrounds.
Right.
And then, like, you had God of War, which was the environments are made of polygons, but the camera is fixed, and you just move from one – it's like Resident Evil, basically. You move from one static angle to the next. So that's kind of the heritage of that style of game.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They're almost like dioramas a lot of times.
With the next platforms that – the 360 PS3 stuff, you didn't have to worry too much about that. You could start to adventure into things like open world games. And you had games, so, I mean, you had games like...
Too Human.
No, not like nothing like Too Human. I said games, plural, too, so you would say you have game like Too Human. But you had stuff like the first Assassin's Creed game, where it was just about, this is a big world you can kind of explore, and it's janky in a lot of ways, but like, look what you can do! You can do this stuff, and you can, and other games sort of said, okay, I can do that, let's push into that space. So yeah, there was sort of this proliferation of open world games, and just like the 3D action games, a lot of them did it badly. Like, there's just this big open space, and you can sort of explore it. But I think what happens is, the novelty of that wears off, and you have to start throwing at other stuff. So
people start stretching for ways to keep it interesting. And again, with open world games, the licensing thing comes into play, where you start to see Simpsons games and Hulk games and Lego games, and a lot of different ways of co-opting this thing that at one time was very groundbreaking.
Right.
And now it just seems kind of, yeah, but what else can you do? You know, or what are you doing to make that really interesting?
To really put... you know, to put a bow on how that particular type of game really sort of dominated, you just need to look at the fact that Ubisoft can't fucking help themselves from making Assassin's Creed games. Like, even when it's clearly not a good idea to try to make two Assassin's Creed games in the same year, the year after you just made one, they still fucking did it. They still went.
Well, we have to look at the sales. I mean, maybe it was a good idea for them.
I mean, in terms of producing a good game that is able to go out by itself, it's like, hey, you guys probably should have taken a little more time with this one.
Sure.
Just give it some thought. But
I think Rockstar has actually been admirably reserved with this, where they don't release a GTA game every 2 years because they know these are humongous games.
You've got to take time. You
have to work really hard to make the worlds interesting, and you know, you got to take your time with it. Yeah, and even then they come out kind of buggy and janky, and everybody puts up with it, but you can't just churn these things out on an annualized basis, and that really doesn't work.
Well, I think with any type of genre, though, you run once the annualization starts up and the annualization engine starts revving, that's when you know that, okay, this genre is probably going to start to hit its Guitar Hero moment. Like, it's going to happen.
Yeah, well, and you know, if we can refocus a little bit on Nintendo stuff, it's weird because a lot this kind of trend where a genre becomes very dominant and then maybe gets oversaturated and then falls away and the people kind of maybe rediscover it 10 years later, it doesn't tend to happen as much on Nintendo systems because there isn't as much third-party support in the modern era. So I'm thinking about like things that Nintendo does.
2D fucking platformers in 2009.
There were occasionally, I think, too many 2D platformers on Wii, or at least they weren't paced. The releases were kind of grouped and clustered weirdly, and it was like, I wouldn't mind three 2D platformers this year if you were making 30 other games, but when you're making 8 games a year and almost half of them are the same genre, that might be too much. And then also Zelda games, you know, and if you mash together the 3D and the 2D, which are admittedly kind of different experiences, but there's a lot of overlap as well, I feel like at some point there were just too many damn Zelda games. And I don't know if they're slowing down right now. But they're subsisting on remakes to kind of fill in the gaps, which to me is kind of okay, because if you're like, I don't feel like playing that again, then you can skip it and you don't really feel like you missed anything. And then maybe you're ready by the time they bring out the new one. But for a while there, it felt like there was a new Zelda game like every, you know, 12 months or 18 months. And it's just like, man, I don't know.
You went Wind Waker, then you had Minish Cap.
It was 5 years between Link to the Past and Ocarina, with Link's Awakening.
But granted, they invented a whole new genre of gameplay at that point. So I mean, there's so,
yeah, sort of, but
you're right. It was Wind Waker and Minish Cap. I think there was probably about 18 months there, and then you roll into their talking Twilight Princess, and they talk Twilight Princess for fucking ever because that game took forever to come out. And then they're on to the two DS games.
The first DS game, I think, was what, 2005, 2006?
Something
so
like that.
So it would have been around the same time as Twilight Princess.
It was pretty soon after. And then the next
we don't have to count them all, but there were just a lot. And I think slowing down on that franchise is a good thing. And the same with like Super Mario. They really, I'm glad there's no Super Mario game this year. You know, Captain Toad is sort of honorary, but
I think the other thing that is good, and they did this, and I say good, I mean, I called this game a cash-in, and I hold to that, but I think, you know, doing stuff with that franchise, like, they made a fucking Dynasty Warriors game with Zelda. What? What are you doing? But, like, they took a franchise that they had, and they're going to make one. They're going to have a Zelda game this year, but it's you know, it's not a Zelda game. It's a different genre. So they're sort of reintroducing a genre back into the pool of what is available on their system. With Captain Toad, it's a puzzle game, effectively.
Sure.
And I mean, it feels like, I mean, it's, if it wasn't Mario themed, then it is Mario themed. If it wasn't Mario themed, it's the kind of thing that they might release on the eShop with Captain Generic, like out of Pushmo. You know, he's a red blob with a face and feet.
Mallow.
So it's like they could have thrown together some kind of just generic character design to go that, but they put, you know, they put Mario's stuff on it. So they're playing with genre, even though they're kind of staying home in the franchise. So I appreciate that they're doing that. But if you're gonna ask like what, like, I don't think that it's fair to say shooters were this last generation, because shooters really started going, you know, back during the PS2, Xbox, GameCube era. I mean, those games are still big back then.
They seem to go super mainstream though with Halo, the later Halos, and especially Call of Duty.
I think what happened is those games became more cinematic, and they became more big budget, and they became more like this is our $400 million game if you include the marketing. And you're like,
yeah, it got to the point where you go to like a Ubisoft or an EA press conference, and more than half the games they showed were first person shooters.
Yeah.
Yeah, but weird. I mean, but if you go back to EA during when Medal of Honor was still a franchise people gave a shit about back on the generation before the last one, like they were cranking out Medal of Honor games every single year.
But that was their one franchise that did that kind of games, that kind of gameplay.
Yeah, but I mean, Activision had their Call of Duty then too. So you it was like you have your choice. You have two games where you shoot Nazis every year.
And sure. What did Ubisoft have? Like, not Band of Brothers.
They were, I think, made by Gearbox.
No, Brothers in Arms. Ben of That's Brothers it. Is the HBO thing. Yeah, Brothers in Arms.
Yeah. Jeez. Yeah. It's just that genre changed from being like, hey, here's this, you know, this 10-hour campaign where you shoot a million Nazis, to, hey, here's this 5-hour, you know, movie campaign and then a big online presence. Like that genre was still big. It just changed. Like, what was popular in that genre transformed.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a weird thing that happened there. And I mean, we talked about experimenting with genre to try to keep it from like Destiny. I mean, Destiny's, you know, its success in terms of its sales is kind of still kind of up in the air. Is it really doing what they thought it was going to do? We don't know. But like, they went and added a bunch of stuff to make this like, this is your RPG shooter. You're going to run around and you're going to go on quests and you're going to do stuff. It's going to mm-hmm. be totally different.
Right. Yeah, and the sales are funny because Activision always go out of their way to not reveal how much exactly they sold. Like, the numbers that they give are always relative. Like, this was like the top selling game on the PSN. And then the people have played this many hours combined, like this many millions of hours combined. And there's no way you can get a figure out of them. Like, how many did you actually sell?
It's like, hey, is this game really the $2 billion franchise you thought it was going to be? Give me an answer, Activision. I know it's not because you've told investors.
Sometimes those announcements, I feel like, are just kind of packaged for a throwaway quote on Entertainment Tonight.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
It's like it goes into, you know, generic entertainment news for people who don't play video games, but they want to get a sense of, like, how much do people really play video games?
You might think they're a kid's toy, but video games are big business.
I think it's actually, like, it's actually just deliberately trying to get a Forbes article written about them. It's like, hey, like, they should just start those press releases with, hey, Eric Kane, comma, bam, here's your text. It's like, Jesus Christ. Christ.
Well, let me throw out one that is pretty obvious, but it hasn't come up yet. I think in the past 2 or 3 years especially, we have seen an amazing rush of roguelite games. And which is a kind of RPG, but it's a very specific kind of RPG. But roguelikes are, I think, a legitimate kind of like their own genre, and also they're getting blended into everything nowadays.
Right, and like The Binding of Isaac is actually, it's like surprisingly popular with like teenagers, and you see a lot of you know, YouTube personalities,
teenagers.
No, but like you look at what's being played on YouTube, and that's what you see.
Spelunky, you know, similar, a different kind of game, still has a lot of the same roguelike stuff. And, you know, those have gotten popular in parallel with streaming video, you know, people watching other people play video games, which didn't exist 5 years ago. And now it's a huge thing. And it has brought certain kind of like what should have been, what would have been previously obscure games, and it has made them kind of really popular. I think Minecraft, a lot of the same thing. I would never in a million years, I mean, I played Minecraft. I saw it very early on before it was a craze, and I thought, oh, that's kind of neat, but I would have never guessed that it would be so popular because I didn't understand, and I still don't fully understand the whole, you know, the video streaming thing. And but that is a huge part of it. And people want to watch videos of this stuff being made and of people showing things off. And that is an aspect of games that, you know, we're still coming to terms with how that influences sales and how that drives the industry and how that it drives developers to choose what kinds of games to make.
But I still think that, I mean, if you're talking about like big commercial dominating games, that the roguelikes really aren't in that sphere because they're not. You're not seeing like, you know, here's our $300 million ad blitz for Spelunky.
Sure.
Well, that's because they're largely coming out of indie developers.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think they are infiltrating more mainstream like AAA stuff also.
Yeah. And it's like you just have the video games industry, like they always seem to be chasing a trend, you know, every time that one game hits it big, everyone tries to emulate it. And that goes for the you know, the big AAA publishers, but it also goes for the indie.
Indies in a lot of ways are worse.
Yeah, everyone is cloning Minecraft, and I don't know if like Flappy Grumpy Cat is a thing, but I'm sure it is.
It is now! You know. I mean, like on the Wii U, I think it was 2 weeks ago, like Meme Runner came out. That thing's fucking insufferable. Like, just watch the video of that. You contemplate taking your own life. I mean, it will happen.
I don't need to see it.
You will think, man, I don't know if I want to live anymore. Because that's what that thing will do to you.
Well, Endless Runners are also another one that became like weirdly a genre all of a sudden. And I'm sure, you know, Cannibalt and other iOS games had a lot to do with it. But that is now a thing that you see all over the place. And right. Even has been it brought into Mario. Like, it doesn't get much more mainstream than, you know, Super Mario 3D World has levels that are kind of structured like an Endless Runner.
Except they end.
Right.
They do, but they play very much like that, where your character's automatically running and all you have to do is jump, but you have to jump perfectly.
Yeah, and you had that in the New Super Mario Brothers 2 when you got shut out of the cannons. Mm-hmm. You had the auto runner gameplay.
The DLC in New Super Mario Brothers 2, the one that they referred to as like, this is Satan's DLC. Like that's more in line with the kind of stuff that we've seen become popular as people like to watch other people stream their own suffering.
Yeah.
Like that DLC, the one in question, the one that's like, this is the hardest thing Nintendo will ever make. Like, that DLC is fucking miserable. Like I got to the third stage of 3 and I was like, oh, I'll never see the end of this stage because you have to be so perfect the entire time of the first 2 stages that I got here. I got here, and that's all that matters. It's like I made it to like the third camp on Everest. I'm good. I can come back down. It's mm-hmm. like, but like that's the cruel difficulty thing. I think with the advent and the spread of streaming yourself playing and suffering, and the fetishization of watching people feel pain, has sort of allowed people to be more mainstream with experimenting with this game's just not fair. Here it is. Have fun.
1001 Spikes. I mean, again, it's an indie game, so I don't know, you know, how you know. I still need to play that. By the way,
I think that MOBAs are kind of what we're going to see more, because big companies are taking big gambles on trying to make successful MOBAs, and they're failing, but they're trying. I mean,
I feel like MOBAs are running into the same problem. Do you remember when? This was about probably 2005, 2006. There was a weird era of people trying to put RTS games on console.
Yeah.
And there were one or two companies who tried over and over and over. And they made a lot of progress on the interface, but the audience was never there. And I think it's going to be that way with MOBAs, is that people are going to say, well, you know, Dota is extremely popular, but a lot of people don't have the patience or the time to get into it. So we just have to make something that's as good as Dota, but easier to get into.
But, you know,
what they're going to find is that if you wanted to play Dota, you probably would have just put in the time in the first place and play the real thing. And I think there will be a lot of copycats and a lot of twists on that formula, but I don't really think that genre is going to go super mainstream. I just don't think that many people want to play that kind of game. They're already doing it. You can play those games for free. So you're not really waiting for the next big one, you know?
Right. Well, the one place where they've seen some success at getting outside of either League or Dota, because if it, like, besides that turf war, that's really the, you know, ground zero, is these, there's a couple, I can't remember the names though, that are like, that are mostly centered around touch devices that are simplified versions, simplified interfaces, maybe less classes, you know, less complicated stuff. And those have had some success in terms of selling additional content packs. Like that, they're free, they're in the freemium model. They kind of work because they're targeting a different consumer who's just using a completely different device set. And they've had some success there. And that might be where you, like, I feel like that stuff is gonna, people are gonna make more passes at it. If the idea is, what are people gonna throw money at to try to be the next big one? I mean, there's constant talk that Blizzard's like, they're like, we have to do our own because we sort of missed the bus on this one. Now, they haven't announced one, but I don't know. It just seems like, honestly, it seems like, and I hate to say this, but coming up with ways to make freemium games might be the next big push amongst major publishers.
I was hoping we'd already peaked on that.
But we haven't. I mean, we've seen that. I mean, they keep finding ways to push us off the ledge. It's like, hey, how about we make a Dungeon Keeper game? But make it fucking terrible.
One that's on the horizon. I think these things are often driven by technology. And I think one big one that may be coming up is once virtual reality really kicks off, which is probably within the next 12 months, it's going to start to really get pretty serious. I think horror games and like survival horror games will make a big comeback, but in this, you know, completely new perspective of being in first person and being in virtual reality. Well, and I think those games just work well in that environment and that on that tech. And a lot of people will be interested in those.
I mean, we've already seen a lot of independent horror games get made, again, driven by this whole culture of seeing some person freak out every time they play Five Nights at Freddy's.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, there's that game. That game only exists because people stream it on Twitch. Because otherwise, it's a simulator in watching cameras and closing doors. That's what that game is.
It's Night Trap.
It's not even Night Trap because you're only closing two doors. Right and left door. That's that whole game.
Sounds like PT.
Did you close the right or left door at the time right before the robot came in to kill you? Probably not. Well, then you're dead. That's that game. That's all that game is. But that game exists because people freak the fuck out playing it on Twitch.
Well, it's funny. You know, a lot of the progress and newer trends that we've talked about do reference back to that idea of people being able to watch other people play. And of course, that's something that Sony and Microsoft, their new systems allow you to do natively, and Nintendo's does not. And I think Nintendo should be kind of concerned about this going forward. I think they are in danger of being left behind in the dust right at the moment where they're almost caught up and they feel kind of relevant and modern in a lot of ways. I mean, there's a lot to be said for the fact that Nintendo ships games that actually work on the day that they come out. And, you know,
you said they're relevant and modern. That's neither relevant nor modern to how the industry is currently working.
It feels downright futuristic at this point. So, in some ways, and so I think Nintendo's getting a lot of credit for that stuff. But if the next genre, if yet another like huge hit, huge trend, it kind of lies in a space that they don't have access to because of their technological limits, then I think they're going to be in trouble. You know, it already feels like they're playing catch up with stuff like Skylanders. And I don't think it's clear at all that Amiibo, will make sense for them outside of people who literally just want the toys.
Sure.
Because I don't think people are buying Amiibo because Smash Brothers. I think they're buying Amiibo because Amiibo.
Right.
And that may work out for them. But ultimately, that's not really what Nintendo wants. And that's not, I think that would severely limit what their plans are for that product line.
Well, I mean, the biggest problem we have is they've only really announced how Amiibo works in like three games. They keep telling us it's going to work in fucking everything. Well,
yeah.
Then tell us, bro.
All this is clearly right. Very rushed. And that's also the danger is that because they kind of get it on the market and then figure out what it's for afterward. Which is the same thing they did with Wii U. I was going
to say, you mean the Wii U? Yeah. You mean the 3DS? You mean the DS?
It certainly gives the danger that they made a lot of decisions up front that were bad decisions that they may not be able to go back and fix.
I mean,
what if they come out with Amiibo Edition 2 that does not work with, you know, like it has newer features, it has the stuff that it should have had in the first place. Can you get away with that?
They will. I mean, so when Amiibo was first announced, I can't remember who I got in an argument with about, but I was arguing outright that Amiibos need to be color-coded. Like, there needs to just be a band at the top that says, Series fucking 1. And then on the back of every game box, it just shows the bands of which Amiibos work with that game.
Because it seems like the way they're going to handle that is just, you know, because all the ones currently are from Smash Brothers and they're on that Smash coin, the token that is the base.
Right.
Whatever they do after this with Amiibo will not have that. It'll have something else, or it'll be in some different form factor. And so that will be the way that you'll know that it's from a later edition.
Yeah, but I mean, like, the back of the box just needs to say, it works with these. Like,
it just, yeah, gives, which just, it like, definitely just, doesn't.
No. Because there will be more Amiibos, and they will not work with Smash because they are not in – well, we say that, but I don't know.
Probably not.
Yeah, I mean
– of course, Smash has such a crazy roster that it covers a lot of bases already.
Right. I mean, could they
it's a great starter, but –
could they just push a fucking patch that says that now you get items? Congratulations. we unlock some stuff.
Yeah, sure. Hyrule did that.
Yeah, I mean, they did. Warriors. It's like, hey, now you have – now you have the spinner, you know, that item you used 4 times in this game. It's like, mm-hmm. Great. I didn't want that. Didn't want that in the game either. Thanks a lot.
Well, it's better than the 1 rupee that some figures give you.
Yeah. But see,
total trolling.
It's just trolling at that point. And that's okay in that game. In that game,
I think it's just randomized, though.
I'm okay with the Amiibo kind of pulling my chain on a little bit. Like, if I go put Princess Peach on Hyrule Wars and it goes like... nothing. Sorry, bro. Like it just straight tells me that. I'd be like, yeah, all right. Well played. Good job by you. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know that I feel like this generation, in a lot of ways, feels iterative. I mean, we probably say that every time. But I don't think we've seen any – if we're talking explicitly in the console space, I don't think we've seen anything come out where I'm like, whoa, that's new.
It's still early days. Even for Wii U after 2 years, I think there's still potential for something to come out on there that's really a breakthrough.
Right.
And you know, whether it's, you know, sort of saves that console or whatever, is another question. But I certainly think it's possible that something could come out on there that we've really never seen before. And that is going to happen on the other systems because they've got so many developers working on them.
I will say at this point, last time, we'd already started to see things like Dead Rising start to kind of circulate. We're like, oh, okay, that's going to happen. I gotcha. And we're not quite there yet in this generation. And I feel like you saw that at E3 this year where a lot of people kind of said, here's some stuff for show. I had stuff for this year. And like even when you walked around the booths, like there was kind of not empty feeling, but you'd walk around like, man, you're not really showing off a lot of the big games you talked about, are you? So I feel like just everything's still really early, even though it's not early.
You know, the more expensive and difficult development processes have delayed the cycle of when you expect to see sort of the second round
right.
of maturity in games for new platforms. And I think the same applies for Wii U, although maybe they're catching up faster. You know, there's some stuff on Smash Brothers for Wii U that you couldn't have done on previous consoles. You know,
right.
I mean, you could maybe do it on PS3, but I'm not even sure of that. And it's impressive. That game is it's a showcase, and you're like, wow, okay, we're this is something. This is something I've never seen before.
When that game holds 1080 60, and John and I are just loading up the thing with explosives, and we've set off,
or you've got an 8-player battle going on. That's
yeah,
on one system is crazy. It's amazing.
We loaded up 2 AI level 9s on a stage that's just chaos. I think it might have been the Great Cave Offensive. And it was just that stupid Olimar spaceship that just goes in giant explosion every time. And like the game just handled it. It's just like, yeah, sure.
Well, that's the awesome thing about Smash Brothers is that the structure of the game almost begs you to stress test it.
Right.
It's like, you try to break our engine. Just try it, buddy. Here's every option you could ever want.
Yeah, and it held up. And like, we had a couple moments where the frame rate dipped, and you're like, oh, there it goes! But like, by and large, it kept it together. Which, yeah, you probably, if you put that game on the last generation of consoles, it would not have held together. It would have gone,
Can you clearly differentiate between a frame rate drop and lag from being online?
Yes.
How do you do it? I'm curious what your technique is.
So a lot of times it's I'll see it and John won't, or he'll see it and I won't if we're playing together.
So you just have to be comparing notes.
Like, but there's something about it. Like, it doesn't feel like the game slowed down, but the animations definitely did. Like you're still moving as fast as you were before, but it's jerkier.
So it feels like the game can't keep up with the action anymore.
When there is lag, the clock definitely slows down.
Yeah, when there's lag, the actual game slows down. Like so when we had the match that we've joked about where it got down to like 1/6 speed, like it was still 60 frames per second, but there were a lot more frames per animation going on.
Yeah, yeah.
So like you can see the smoothness of the motion starts to go away, but the actual speed of the game doesn't. And that's kind of it's kind of a hard thing to describe, but when you see it you kind of know, oh okay, that's a frame rate issue, not a lag issue.
Well, and also with frame rate we know that some people are just very sensitive to it and some people aren't.
Yeah.
You know, I think it has to be pretty bad before I get distracted by it and actually realize that it's happening. I think it's subconscious a lot of times.
I notice dips, but if a game is locked at 50, like, which is a weird thing, if it's locked at 30, I might notice it's not running at 60. I mean, I'll probably notice it's not running at 60, but I won't notice all the time. But when it dips, I pretty much always notice.
Mm-hmm.
It's consistency is super important, and we're way off.
Yeah,
the weeds
yeah.
Now.
We should probably just skip ahead to the next email, but it was a good discussion.
Where the fuck did we go?
I don't know, but James, why don't you read the final email here so we can wrap up this episode?
All right, Daniel from Australia writes, "I saw an article online the other day about how Pokemon's success leads to Nintendo's doom. This article was pretty much along the lines of that because of the most recent Pokemon game sold so well, it means less reason for Nintendo to need to go to third party and end up porting Pokemon games to mobile platforms. For some reason, Nintendo making a bucket load of money on their own system for a game that they make for their own systems is a bad thing. And this isn't a solo article predicting Nintendo's doom and gloom. I saw an article on Polygon talking about how Disney can save Nintendo the other week, which is just another in the countless articles telling us why Nintendo is going to fail and how to fix them. So my question is this. Why do you think Nintendo seems to be attracting these kinds of articles more than other companies in the industry? They seem to be one of the most polarizing companies in the industry. Every few months, we seem to see the usual rollout articles, places like Polygon or Kotaku, Time.com, or any number of other random blogs online about how Company X can save Nintendo, or Nintendo is doomed and here's how to save them. Many of them just seem to have the attitude of, I want to play Nintendo games, but I don't want to buy their hardware, so here's what they should do so I can play their games. I've always been of the mindset that if you want to play Nintendo games, you need to buy their systems, which is something I'm sure a lot of Nintendo fans share. First off, I want to say, if you're reading Polygon, you've already fucked up. Hmm. So, if you're reading Kotaku, your parents fucked up. So,
wow.
You gotta say, though, I mean, it's so surprising to still see some pundits beat the mobile drum because... Like, today, Rovio had some good news. They're only laying off, like, 110 employees instead of 130. Because Angry Birds is not popular anymore. And apparently, you can't ride one franchise forever. You've got to diversify your hits. And, oh, my God.
So, I want to explicitly talk about this article he saw. He saw it on Yahoo, which reprinted it from another site. And the guy who wrote it, I don't have his name in front of me because he's a fucking idiot. But so first off, this article should have never been published by Yahoo. And there's a pretty fucking important reason. This guy had an enormous conflict of interest in that he works for companies that advise the Finnish video game market. And by the way, the Finnish video game market is a bunch of Rovio exes who went and founded their own mobile games companies. Right. Basically, he has a financial interest in Nintendo not existing anymore as a hardware manufacturer. And so this article, A, shouldn't have been written, and B, should have carried a big old fucking disclosure. Didn't have either of those. So this article exists because this guy wants Nintendo to go away because it'll make him money. That's the biggest issue here. I mean, he advocates for, imagine if they put out an Advance Wars game where you got to give them money every week. Wouldn't that be exciting? No! That would be fucking terrible. You're a fucking terrible person. I hate you.
Yeah. Well, yes. And I can't dispute any of that. That's interesting and troubling. But I'll also say, I think there are a lot of, I don't know about a lot. I think there are a vocal number of people who kind of have said very similar things who probably don't have direct conflicts of interest. So I don't think that totally insubstantiates the position that this guy is taking here.
His position is probably the most, just the most disgusting way I've seen it.
Yeah, the presentation of it is bad.
Imagine if Animal Crossing, all you had was one shirt and then you gave him real cash for your house. Fuck off! I don't need this.
Yeah, and you could say maybe he's talking from some kind of Motley Fool kind of perspective of, you know, we really want their stock price to get better because, you know, we advise people on financial matters and so, or we just think companies should keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger all the time like crazy. And so, we're going to try to tell them what to do in that respect. I just think most of the time these articles are written by people who really either don't know much about video games or very specifically don't know much about Nintendo.
I would say, so here's,
and it's pretty easy to tell when they're
not. Here's the thing, and to get right to the heart of the question of why do people write these about Nintendo? And it's, there's a real fucking term for it called Nintendo baiting. Because Nintendo fans get fucking pissed off because these articles keep getting written, and then they go and spread them on Nintendo fan message boards, which, by the way, there's a lot more of those are than there are like Xbox fan message boards.
Yeah, as a forum dweller myself, I can confirm that every time one of these fucking stupid articles would be published, someone would post it on whatever Nintendo forum you are.
And guess what? Kotaku and Polygon only sell clickbait!
So everyone just seems to fall for it, and they just want to read the article and want to be outraged and want to tell the author how dumb they are, and the author probably, you know, laughs his way to the bank to deposit his $10 check. I don't know. But yeah, Nintendo baiting, it's a real thing.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a big part of it. Here's what's funny. Here's what's fucking goddamn hilarious. Is that Microsoft's current CEO doesn't really like their Xbox division. Like legitimately thinks it's a boat anchor. Doesn't wants no part of it. So do you ever see articles written about that? Fuck no, because they gave Kotaku, or they gave Polygon a bunch of money to make a documentary about how they're changing games journalism. That ain't gonna happen.
I don't know if that's the reason, but it sure looks bad.
It does. You should have a story about it. Like, that's a real news story. That is a CEO of a company saying, hey, this division really doesn't make sense for where we want to be.
Well, and to be fair, I mean, there is a similar thing. It's not the CEO, but it's the stockholders of Nintendo. A lot of them, apparently, or at least a vocal minority, really want them to go mobile and don't understand why they're not doing it. So it makes sense that you would see commentary taking that position, at least as a devil's advocate, like, hey, let's play this out. What does this mean for games? I'm just amazed that anyone could play out that scenario and come out thinking it would be good. But yeah. Okay, but apparently some people have different standards than I do.
Especially in the enthusiast press. If you're staking out that ground in the enthusiast press, you know what the fuck you're doing. Because you can't stake out, yeah, I mean, turning baseline games into mobile platforms has worked great for Dungeon Keeper. People love that game. No, people wanted to burn down EA's offices for that game. You should know better.
I really do think though that Daniel pretty much hit the real reason for the vast majority of this stuff happening, which I don't even think is as conspiratorial as, you know, a behind the scenes conflict of interest or even clickbaiting. I think it's a lot of just jealousy. I think it's people who grew up with Nintendo, who wish they could still play their games, but don't want to have to buy a third platform. And they say, I sure would like to play Mario, but I don't want to buy one of those Wii U's. So how do I get from A to B? Oh, they must go third party or whatever. Or at least if they put it on my cell phone, I could at least play with it sometimes or get a version of Pokemon.
He's quoting an actual article. I think the Cooch wrote it.
I think that Ben Kuchera at Polygon explicitly says stuff like that, like explicitly points to his children playing iPad games and, we could all be playing Smash Brothers if only Smash Brothers were an iPad, you know?
Fuck you,
if
Ben
only
Kuchera.
Smash Brothers was terrible, then yeah, we right. could all play it on our iPads. Yes. And that's the part that they don't mention. But I think this comes out of like a real foolish desire by, you know, people who play a lot of video games to say, man, I want to play more Nintendo games, but I don't want to go through the hassle of buying those systems. And that is, I understand why people feel that way, but also the solution is very easy. Buy the system.
Or don't play the games.
Like, or just to, or put up with it. I mean, the games either appeal to you or don't, but Nintendo survives. I mean, this isn't holding them back. This is the reason they still exist, is that they make people want to buy their systems because their games are so damn good. And if they give that privilege up, they don't exist anymore. Their reason to be, it's just the right. Formula doesn't work if you open that platform. It has to be closed.
Well, and
their games have to be exclusive to their platforms. Otherwise, Nintendo games don't get made. So please get this through your skulls and quit finding ways to circumvent the very harsh reality of it.
Here's the other part that makes this this whole thing just dumb, is that, hey, how many companies are successful making mobile games over and over again? I'm gonna give you a hint. I'm gonna give you a hint. The answer is zero. By the way, the answer is zero. There are zero companies who have nailed two huge hits in a row. It just doesn't happen. I mean,
Infinity Blade.
Kinda, yeah, but I mean,
I don't know how huge they were, but they were popular.
That got a tremendous push from Apple. Like,
yeah, I mean, they weren't Candy Crush, but they were popular. They sold well, right. I believe.
But Guillaume just hit the nail on the head with Rovio. Like,
right.
Like their net income last year, I think, was like 26 million euros, which is like, that's a big number. That's not what it was 2 years ago. 2 years ago, it was like big. It was like, hey, no, you're going to have to give us a shit ton of money to make an Angry Birds game, a movie. Like, you don't, we don't talk unless you're coming in with 10 million euros.
Right. And most of that money was coming from licensing. It was not coming from mobile revenue.
Right. And guess what? That stuff falls off. And guess what? Rovio's had a bunch of layoffs.
Yeah, and Nintendo doesn't need to make mobile games to license their stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. It's already popular. It's already known.
And it's hard to get attention in the mobile space. I mean, it just is. It's very difficult because you're competing with the fact that there's a million games released every single day.
Yeah, and by their games being exclusive to their platforms, they sort of get a carved out section of the industry that's devoted to their stuff, whereas if it was just available on anything and everything, then it's just going to get blended in with everything else. And maybe it is way better than the competition, but it's going to be very easy for people to ignore it or to clone it or to recommend alternatives. And again, it is in Nintendo's interest to not let that happen. It will dilute the quality of their games. It will dilute the pricing of their games. I mean, that people made fun of Iwata when he talked about protecting the prices of their games, but that's some real shit. You know, and he didn't express himself very well when he talked about that, but that's important.
But you know what? I mean, I've heard mobile devs talk about, like, man, the race to the bottom is killing us. Like, shit like Flappy Birds becomes a thing.
And it will kill Nintendo, and I'd rather not happen.
And additionally, let's say they go third party but stay in the console space. Okay, how many third party publishers are having a great time right now? How many? How many exist right now?
Like, they've consolidated all hell.
How many third-party publishers in Japan are having a lot of fun right now? I'll give you the hint. The answer is none. There aren't any. Konami had a booth this year, and no games were in it. Capcom put out zero original games last year. Zero. None. None. There were no original games released last year by Capcom. Everything was a port or a remake.
There's also a lot of stuff that, you know, people – and I think – you know, sometimes you get outside perspectives on the industry or on our slice, our Nintendo flavored slice of the industry, and they're healthy. It's good to hear from people who aren't as entrenched in it, who have fresh ideas, who kind of, you know, take a different perspective that we might not take because we're too close to it. But a lot of times I feel like the people who comment, who write this stuff, really don't know much about Nintendo because they maybe haven't played a Nintendo system in 10 years, right? They just gave it up. They moved on to other things and they say, man, I'd love to get back into that stuff. So they don't even know necessarily much about the games Nintendo's releasing nowadays, but I certainly don't think they know much about the company because Nintendo is designed for stability. They are a scrappy, robotic, when people say ultra conservative, there's good and bad to that, right? But I mean, the company has been around for over 100 years. They are built to last. They have low operating costs. They have a huge cash surplus, which gives them tons of breathing room when they mess up to come back from it. And that is by design. And they are not going to get knocked down by just one or two mistakes. So they may have to live with their mistakes for longer than we would like, but they will keep coming back. And again, if you fundamentally change the way the company operates and you drastically change the way that they make their money, you're putting all that at risk. And this is a company that is designed to not take those kinds of risks.
Well, I think the other thing is, and to pardon the use of a, you know, a phrase that's often used, we talk about the idea of chasing, you know, two birds in the bush. Going completely changing your entire business model, which is what they'd have to do, is an incredibly risky endeavor. I mean, it is the riskiest thing you can do. You're saying, I have a business model that is in some way, shape, or form successful for me. And even when they weren't making money, when they were losing money, it wasn't a complete failure of a business model. They're not fucking Radio Shack. They had good revenue, but it wasn't good enough. But they still had a product that people obviously wanted, just not in the numbers they needed to get there.
Yeah, and their approach to solving that problem, and I think this just really shows you what kind of company Nintendo is, and it's the tortoise and the hare approach.
Just keep doing it. Just keep doing it.
They're just, we're going to do it. We're going to do it better. We're going to do it better than we have in the past and better than the other guys. And slowly over time, people will come around. Now, ultimately, will that be enough? You know, will that kind of save their asses? I don't know, man. I mean, you know, in the fullness of time, will we say that Wii U was a success? Probably not. But they're trying to make it a relative success. They're trying to turn it into something right. that they can feel good about and that their consumers can feel good about, which is they're doing right by us. We're by the people who want the system and who already bought it. They're releasing the games that we want and the games are coming out great. And that's what they got to do. And, you know, maybe they're not turning things around as fast as we would like. And maybe they're not taking some of the radical steps that I might like to see, but it seems to be paying off to some extent. I think we'll find out more next week when the NPDs hit. I think we'll start to get a sense of just how much they are turning around.
We know already because they sent out their self-congratulatory email that they sold was 800,000 copies of Smash Brothers in the U.S. in 3 days. So to put that in perspective, was it Unity? Assassin's Creed Unity sold about 1.5 million in that week across two systems.
Well, and PC.
And PC. So it's like, okay, so with 4 more days, it sold less than twice as many units despite having way more availability. So yeah, it's not like they're dying here. That's a successful fucking game launch. The Pokemon game cited in the article here, was it sold 3 million copies in Japan at launch? It's like, there's 100 million people in Japan. 3 out of 10 bought this game. It's fucking ridiculous. That's fucking ridiculous.
They're doing all right. And I mean, the article admitted that it was a huge success. It was just kind of trying to twist that into some kind of negative for the company, which I think is obscene. It presupposes that what they need to do is stop making 3DS games. And I don't think that's correct at all. I don't think any of us do. But it is sort of ridiculous. And that guy probably should have spoken should have run that article by a couple more people before he put it out there in public, because I think he comes out looking like an asshole and also just, you know, I don't think he's really convincing anybody who actually plays video games. If anything, the examples that he used and the extremes that he took the argument, I think undermined any kind of like, you know, initial credibility that the idea might have had. Mm. So.
Yeah, like out of context, I tweeted some quotes and some people were like, hey, actually, I would like to see like a new campaign monthly of Advance Wars for $2. And then, whoa, but wait, here's the article. And they were like, whoa.
Well, see,
whoa, no.
see that presupposed, though, that a game comes first. Like, here is a full game that you can play.
Yeah, he was kind of arguing for like shells. You know, here's the free shell that with like a tutorial, and then you have to pay $3 per pack for all the missions, and there's no bundling, and there's no subscription. That's the only way to play the game.
Yeah.
That's because that's the way mobile games work in a lot of cases.
Right. And it's not
the Mario Kart expansion DLC. That is the, you know,
that's the everything
free
DLC
version, and there's not much to it, and you have to pay for everything. Yeah.
Right.
I don't think many people want that, even on the Wii U or the 3DS.
No.
All right, guys. Well, that's going to have to be the end of our episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening and for writing in your emails. We got a few that we still didn't get a chance to talk about this week, including one that has to wait for John to get back before we read that one for special reasons.
Oh, God. But
Yeah. But anyway, we love hearing from everybody. And thank you so much for igniting these great conversations that we have. I think they're a lot of fun for us, and people seem to find them interesting. So if you have an idea or a question or a comment on a recent game or recent news article, please send that in to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We would really appreciate it. And we do read all of them, and we use as many as we can. So thanks again to everybody who supports us in that way. And before we go, I want to give a couple of plugs. First off, just to remind everybody that the Famicast is now on its own subscription feed. They have been for about a month. And so, you know, that was a monthly show. If you've kind of been thinking, man, it seems like it should have been probably about time for a new Famicast. There have been a couple actually recently that you might have missed if you haven't subscribed to that. So go over there and do that. They're putting out some great stuff. It's really funny. They even got a new theme song by Perry, who did our new theme song, and they're really building their own little empire over there, and we want to encourage people to go support it. So check that out to hear about all the games coming out in Japan and about life in Japan in general. It's very interesting stuff and a lot of fun to listen to. And then finally, it's a good time of the year to go subscribe to the new NWR TV channel on YouTube if you like watching videos of games. And if you maybe, you know, got a little sneak preview from last episode where we had a full video version of the podcast with us playing Smash Brothers for over an hour, there's a lot more stuff in that, not exactly like that, but in that vein, and a lot of video reviews going up this time of year. So you can check all that stuff out over at YouTube. I believe it is youtube.com/NinWRTV. But if you search for NWR, you will find it. And there's a link from last week's show notes as well, right under the embedded videos. So I do recommend you subscribe to that. If you're a YouTube user, you'll get a lot of mileage out of our channel. We put up a lot of stuff on there, and not all of it makes it to the front page of the website. So it's worth checking out. All right, guys, that's going to do it. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll be back next time.
Later.
Bye.
Daniel from Australia writes, oh no, this is fucking bullshit. All right, Daniel from Australia writes,